So get ready, because we're going to get started in just 2 minutes. Let's see if we can find a good soundtrack to get us started in the right mindset today. This is a good one. Here we go. Just another minute, we'll get started. All right, guys, we'll get started in one more minute. All right, guys, get my Bluetooth going and we'll rock and roll. Bolin, are you there?
I am. How you doing?
All right. Are we ready to go?
Yes, sir. We're recording. Ready to roll.
Awesome. So thank you, everyone, for joining us on this 4-week virtual boot camp to help you get your law firm business plan written. For those of you who don't know me, for those of you who do know me, I apologize. I'm just going to introduce myself to everyone who doesn't know me, because there's a whole bunch of people on the call who don't really know me and don't really know what How to Manage Small Law Firm is all about. Many of them were just sort of referred by a friend. We get about a third to 40%, 33 to about 40% of our new members every quarter come by way of referral. And what we find is that a lot of people who come by way of referral sort of put their faith and put their trust in the law firm owner who referred them to us, and they don't really know that much about how to manage a small law firm, what we do, why we do it, how we do it, where we came from, and all that. So if you already know that, I apologize. Let me just consider this a refresher. But for those of you who don't, I think it's important for them to know the background. Otherwise, a lot of the things that we're going to be teaching, a lot of the things we're going to be talking about, a lot of the answers I'm going to be giving you live in these calls and on the member discussion forum, they're going to be, a lot of them are counterintuitive, and they're going to be contrary to a lot of conventional wisdom you may have heard. They're going to be contrary to a lot of conventional wisdom you may have been putting into practice in your law firm, and getting less than pleasing results. And it's a little scary. It's a little scary to do things a lot differently than the way most people are doing them. But I promise you, if you want to get the results that most every law firm is getting, then do what everyone else is doing, by all means. If you do what everyone else is doing, you can very reliably, very predictably expect to experience similar results that they're getting. But that's not why you're here. You're here because you're more ambitious than most lawyers. That's a good thing. And I mean that sincerely. It is a good thing to be ambitious as the owner of a law firm when you understand that a law firm makes money, makes a profit as a byproduct of helping more people. So all things being equal, $1 million law firm, a law firm that grosses $1 million a year, it's got to help twice as many people as a law firm that grosses $500,000 a year, or the same number of people, but it helps them twice as much. Similarly, a law firm that grosses $500,000 a year has to help twice as many people, or help the same number of people twice as much, as a law firm that grosses only $250,000 a year, and so on and so forth. The point is, we should never apologize. We should never be embarrassed. We should never hide from the fact that we have an ambition to use our business to help more people, to make the world a better place. That is the ambition. So, you know, most lawyers are afraid of acknowledging and admitting that they have ambitions of having a more successful law firm. You get them in private, of course, they all want, you know, they want to make more money, they want to work fewer hours, they want to help more clients, they want to have a better staff that's more productive. They want all the things that that everyone on this call is honest with ourselves enough to acknowledge that we want, which is why we're here. The problem is they're not willing to embrace it. And it is precisely this internal conflict that's at the root cause of so many problems that we see with so many law firms. There is what's called a dark side. We all have a dark side. And I don't mean like Star Wars, the Empire, you know, the Star Wars to join the dark side. That's not what the dark side means. The dark side is not a part of yourself that's bad. The dark side is a part of yourself that you keep hidden from the rest of the world. You keep it hidden in the dark. And the part that most people keep hidden in the dark, that they exert so much time and energy, mental energy, emotional energy, psychic energy, trying to hide from the world, sometimes even trying to hide from themselves, it is the part of themselves, and I'm going to say ourselves, because I used to have this big problem myself, and I had to learn about this, and when I learned to stop hiding my dark side from the world, my business became easier to run, marketing became easier, sales became easier, managing staff became easier, everything about my business became easier. In the book Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill, which, by the way, if you have not read it, I would encourage you to listen to an audio program that I created years ago entitled Think and Grow Rich for Lawyers. And what I did was I basically read the book, narrate the book, and sort of talk about it as it applies to the life of a solo or small law firm owner. If you have read the book, you might want to revisit that and get a refresher and get some ideas as to how it applies to the business of running a law firm. It's one of those books that I like to revisit every couple of years anyway, because every time I revisit that book, Think and Grow Rich, I find that I'm a different person and I discover it is a different book. It's one of those kinds of books. Anyway, in the book, Think and Grow Rich, Napoleon Hill describes a river. And if you imagine the river running east to west, left to right, if you're looking at a picture. And most people begin life at the southern side of the river, at the bottom part below the river. The river is going left to right, and we're below it looking up at it in the picture. And trying to get to the other side. And on the southern part of the river, flowing to the west, to your left, the river is flowing to the left, and that is taking you to where you don't want to go. And midway through the river, the current changes, and if you get past the middle of the river and get towards the other side, if you get past the middle, the current actually is going the opposite direction. So it's a river flowing in two different directions. The southern part of it is flowing to the left, to the west. The northern part of it, the upper part of it, is flowing to the east, the other way around. And we start off life, and we have to swim so hard against the current just to get to where we want to go, to try to make progress towards where we want to go. Marketing is hard, and we have to swim against the tide of marketing. And sales is hard, and we have to swim against the current for sales. And finding and hiring and training and managing and getting a team to work with us and help us achieve our goals, that's hard. And we have to swim against the current there. And the money is hard. And all the parts of running the business are hard. And then you get to the middle part. And once you get past the middle part, all of a sudden you enter a stream of the current that's flowing in exactly the opposite way. And like instantly, like in a matter of months, everything that used to be hard suddenly stops being so hard. And the further you go, the things that used to be so hard, you wake up one day and it's like everything is easier. And it's amazing. And one day you wake up and you realize, like, I can't believe things used to be so hard, and now they're so easy. I'm going to share some things with you about my personal life throughout this boot camp. I share these things not to impress you. I share these things to impress upon you that I know what it's like to be broke. I know what it's like to be swimming against the current just to stay still. I know what it's like to be exhausted. I know what it's like to have to make really, really tough choices around money and really tough choices around time. And I'm going to share with you parts of my own story, and I'm going to share with you parts of the stories of several of our members who have experienced what it's like when you cross over from the part of the river where everything's working against you to the part of the river where you get everything working with you and even get everything working for you. And that's what I want to help you all make a plan for in these next 4 weeks, is to make a plan to get your business to stop working against you and to get it to start working for you. I know that especially nowadays, in the middle of this, I was going to say in the middle, we're not even in the middle, at the very beginning stages of this global pandemic. And it would be crazy for me to be running this boot camp when the pandemic has just started and not address it, because I know it's on your mind. So let's just talk about it. Yes, I will help you with pandemic-specific tactics. And if we need to, we can organize some pandemic tactic specific extra bonus calls during these next 4 weeks. But I don't want to allow the pandemic to hijack the bigger strategy that we're all here for. Many of you signed up for this boot camp before there was a pandemic, and I want to honor and respect that you signed up for this boot camp because you really have a longer view of what's happening, and the pandemic will eventually resolve itself from a medical standpoint, probably much, much sooner than it resolves itself from a financial standpoint. I personally foresee many months of pandemic related economic impact. And I will share a link with everyone in the discussion forum of a talk that I gave to my staff, to my team here in my office in Miami 3 weeks ago, talking about why and how the pandemic, the economic parts of it, are actually a phenomenal opportunity for growing a law firm. Because remember, law firms generate revenue by solving problems for people, by bringing value to people's lives. That's how law firms generate revenue. Gross revenue. Now, how you keep that and turn it from gross revenue into net profit, that is really the function of your business plan and how efficiently you run your business. So gross revenue is a measure of how much value your law firm delivers to the world. Net income is a function of how efficiently you operate your law firm as a business in delivering that value to the world. So we're going to be talking about both increasing your gross revenue, providing more value to the world, and increasing your net income, keeping more of that in your pocket. Okay, a little background on me and how to manage a small law firm for everyone who isn't familiar. My name is R. John Robbins. I'm the founder and CEO of How to Manage a Small Law Firm. I am a licensed attorney. My Florida bar number is 126713. I've been a member of the Florida Bar in good standing since 1997 or 1998, I don't remember. After law school, I worked for a federal bankruptcy judge, and then I opened my own law firm, and I fell on my face. My law firm was a disaster. It was not a successful law firm. It was not financially very rewarding. It was not personally very rewarding. It was not professionally very rewarding. There has never been a super duper extra successful law firm. The law firm of R. John Robbins emulate this. No, the law firm of R. John Robbins was a cautionary tale that you should avoid. I am not going to be teaching you in this 4-week bootcamp my way. I'm not going to be showing you how I did it for myself. Instead, I'm going to be showing you best practices and an approach that does work, has worked, does work, and will work for thousands upon thousands upon thousands of lawyers from all walks of life, all different practice areas, large cities, small towns. Some of these lawyers were left-handed. Some of them were right-handed. Some of them were tall. Some of them were short. They used these principles of law firm management in good times and in bad. And all things being equal, these fundamental principles, these fundamental best practices of the business of running a law firm, they just plain work. They just plain work. I'm not going to be teaching you like a formulaic, paint by numbers, do it this way, you're a robot, just follow instructions. You're independent thinkers, you're creative people, your law firm, in order for your law firm to reach its full potential, it must be a unique expression of who you are and what you're all about and the value that you are trying to bring into the world. That is the way to make a law firm really, really successful. Law firms that don't do that are never as successful as law firms that do. So I was there, I was struggling with my law firm, and a friend of mine who was a much more experienced attorney, who had built a very successful law firm herself. One day I was basically just whining and complaining, and she told me, "Hey, you should check out the Florida Bar's Law Office Management Assistant Service, the LOMAS program." And so I called them for help. And to make a very, very long story short, the way it basically went is I would call them and I would describe the problems that I was having. And they didn't say this in so many words, but the gist of what they told me is, oh yeah, we've heard that like 1,000 times before. That is an effect. We're familiar with that effect. And causes are what produce effects. So you don't like this effect. You want a better effect. So let's go back to the root cause. And if you'll change this cause, the effect will take care of itself. And that was pretty amazing. And I followed their instructions and I took action on the cause that they diagnosed for me. And sure enough, the effect started to get better. And so I called them again and I said, great, now here's this other effect that I want to improve. And they diagnosed another cause and I took action on that cause and things got better. And just over and over and over again, I would call them and I would describe the problems that I was experiencing, and they would tell me the cause of the effect that I was calling to complain about, and things got better. Till one day, to make a very long story short, I realized I was actually having a lot more fun working on the business than in the business. I was having a lot more fun being an entrepreneur working on my law firm business as compared to the fun that I was having. And it was fun, but not as much fun for me because of the way I'm personally wired. It was more fun working on the business than working in the business as a lawyer. And I expressed this in not so many words. And they basically, to make another very long story short, they ended up recruiting me and I became the first and still today the only lawyer in the history of the state of Florida, Florida being the fourth largest state bar in the country. So that's saying a lot. The only lawyer in the history of the Florida bar to serve as a full-time small law practice management advisor with the Florida Bar's Law Office Management Assistance Service. And what that meant is that every month, like a day in the life or a day in the month of R. John Robbins for 4 years as a Florida Bar Law Office Management Assistance Advisor, small law practice management advisor, about half the month I'd be in the office fielding calls from lawyers on every aspect of starting, marketing, managing, buying, selling, growing, shrinking, strategically retreating, merging, you name it, anything to do with the business of running a law firm, I would get anywhere from 4 to 7 calls a day. So just think about that, 4 to 7 calls a day, just call it 5 calls a day, 5 days a week, that's 25 calls a week dealing with different issues. And I was in the office about half the month fielding these calls. That's about 50 calls a month. That's about 600 calls a year. And I was there for 4 years. That's about 2,400 to 2,500. How do I start a firm? How do I grow a firm? How do I market a firm? How do I sell a firm? What do I do about this? Part of marketing. What do I do about that? Part of billing. What do I do with this billing strategy? What do I do with this staff? You name it. It got to the point where it wasn't the first, it wasn't the second, it wasn't even the 100th time I'd heard the question. It got to like almost name that tune. I can name that problem in 2 notes. I can name that problem in 1 note. I'm not saying this to brag. I'm sure each and every one of you is probably just as experienced in your own unique area of expertise and your own unique area of experience and brilliance. And, you know, some of you have handled 1,000 divorces. Some of you have handled 1,000 bankruptcies. Some of you have handled thousands of immigration matters and thousands of intellectual property matters and thousands, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of trials. And in that area, you probably know as much about that area of the law and what to expect. And you can play name that tune with every problem or issue that a client has ever brought, as I can with the business of running a law firm. So I want to make clear that I have tremendous respect for the fact that outside of my area of mastery, I am very often a novice. Outside of the world of small law firm management, I take my hats off to each and every one of you in your unique practice area. And so when I speak with authority, when I speak with confidence, when I speak from experience in when it comes to any aspect of starting, marketing, managing, buying, selling, growing a successful law firm in any practice area, in any city, good times or bad, I do so just from having 20 years of experience doing this. This is all I've been doing for 20 years. I've done this through corona, through avian flu, through swine flu, through N1, whatever that thing is called, through SARS, through 9/11, through the Hanging Chad thing that held the company hostage, through the mortgage crisis, through the other mortgage crisis. I mean, you name it, I've been through all this stuff. So I share this with you to let you know that you're in good hands. And I'm not going to tell you anything that I don't know from experience that it works. There are no theories here. There are no, it would be nice if only it worked this way. Everything is practical, real world tested, lessons, advice, tools, tips. If there's anything that I haven't experienced before and I'm sharing it with you or encouraging you to try it as a test or as an experiment, I'll let you know. Hey, you know what? I've never done this before, or no one's ever tried this before, but I think it should work. Let's test it. Okay. I launched How to Manage a Small Law Firm in 2008, and I think this is particularly important to mention today as we get into this pandemic. 2008, for those of you who don't remember, was a basically global economic meltdown of global proportions, not unlike what I'm expecting we're going to see in the coming months as the economy begins to experience the impact of all the shutdowns and lockdowns and everything else. So I know what it's like to launch a business in the middle of a very, very challenging economic time. I know what that's like. At the time, I was flat broke. In 2006, my wife had become very, very ill, and I made the economically difficult but emotionally no-brainer decision that I could always build another business. I could always make more money. I couldn't replace her. And so I made the decision to attend to her medical needs and her care needs, and basically let my business fall apart. And I say business, but in truth, it was not a business. It was merely a practice. And if I seem militant, if I get kind of aggressive about this distinction between a practice versus a business, it's because I have a very strong personal connection with the negative effects of settling for a mere practice instead of transforming a practice into a sustainable business that keeps working for you even when everything in your personal life maybe goes to shit. And I have no excuses, right? This is not me saying I know better. This is me acknowledging mea culpa. I knew better. I had already helped thousands of lawyers transform their practices into a business. And yet there I was running a practice, making good money, having a lot of fun, helping a lot of people, but without the kind of processes, procedures, systems, without having built the infrastructure to keep it going when I had to step away from it. So one of our objectives here is not just to help you build a law firm that serves your financial needs, but also to build a law firm that protects your personal life so that if something happens, the whole law firm doesn't collapse and leave you in the same position that I was in when my practice collapsed because I turned my attention to taking care of my wife. To make a very long story short, just in case you're wondering, she has fully recovered. We have a beautiful, almost five-year-old baby or son. He's not a baby anymore. He's now a small adult. And life is great. Everything's good. And we went from losing our home to foreclosure in 2008. We went totally broke in 2008. We burned through all of our credit in 2008, 2009, or 2007, I should say. Everything I just said, I should have said 2007. And really launching how to manage a small law firm in 2008. And the revenues, just to put this in perspective, in 2009, the business grossed $75,000 gross in 2009. In 2000, don't ask me how we lived because I don't know. In 2010, we grew that to $200,000. In 2011, we grew that to $600,000. In 2012, we grew that to $1 million. 2012, we grew that to $1,750,000. The next year, we grew to $3 million, then $4 million, then $6 million, then $8 million, then $11 million. And last year, we grossed just under $15 million. We have 50 full-time staff, and we manage over 400 solo and small law firms all over the country in all the different practice areas. And all of them have as their foundation the things that I'm going to be teaching you and sharing with you and exercises I'm going to be doing with you over these next 4 weeks. So that's me. Next, I have on my agenda to discuss this concept that school is never out for high performers. Well, there it is. School is never out for high performers. I said it. When you see a law firm that's having long-term success, and I've had the privilege and the opportunity to work with some of the most successful small law firms on the planet over the last 20 years. You see that the owners of those firms, they always come to their meetings with their management team and their advisors with a level of humility and curiosity, and humility meaning, we, and I include myself in this because I have my own advisors, we're humbled and even a little bit intimidated, but in a motivating way by how much there is to learn. And it's like the more you learn about the business of running your law firm, the more you'll discover you don't know. And it just makes it a never-ending intellectual challenge and always opportunities to grow. And at every level of growth, there's more interest and more curiosity and more fun stuff, and things just get better and easier. I should mention that it is significantly easier, significantly easier to run a $2 million law firm than it is to run a $1 million law firm. The breaking point between where it becomes much, much, much easier is around $1.5 million. Around $1.5 million is really where things start to shift into high gear and just become so much easier. It is significantly easier to run a $1 million law firm than a $500,000 law firm. It is significantly easier to run a $500,000 law firm than a $250,000 law firm. And there's some basic, simple math that causes the law firm to become easier and easier and easier to run as it gets, as it scales, as you gain scale. And I'd be happy to talk about that in more detail if anyone's interested to raise their hand when we get to the Q&A shortly. But just understand that when I'm talking about a $1 million law firm, if some of you are on here, maybe your firm is only at $100,000 or $200,000 or $300,000, and you're thinking, oh my God, $1 million law firm, I can't work 10 times harder than I'm working already. How am I going to work 10 times harder? How am I going to work 3 times harder? And the answer is you don't have to. It actually works the other way around. The bigger the firm gets, the less you have to work, the easier it becomes to run. So just keep that in mind. And if you've been lowering your expectations and negotiating against yourself in terms of your goals, keep in mind that the larger the firm gets, if it's built the right way, I should say. If it's built the right way, the larger it gets, the easier it becomes to run, not the hard, not, it doesn't become harder. Okay. There's a few things to keep in mind around this concept of school is never out for high performers. I want to warn everyone here, and none of you are going to get infected by this bad, dangerous mindset, probably for a long time. But I want to inoculate you against it right here, right now. This concept of too cool for school. Too cool for school tends to happen when a law firm owner breaks the seven-figure barrier for the first time. And it's like the teenager who, you know, thinks that they know everything because they're a teenager. And they don't even know what they don't know that they don't know. And I just want to warn you that no matter how big your law firm becomes, no matter how financially successful your law firm becomes, no matter how many staff you have, no matter how much gross revenue you have, no matter how much profit you take out of it, there's always more to learn. And when you catch yourself feeling like you know it all, that's when you know you're in real trouble. We've got members of How to Manage a Small Law Firm. The largest law firm in How to Manage a Small Law Firm today had gross revenues last year of around $40 million with over 100 employees. We have members of How to Manage a Small Law Firm who are just getting started and their revenues are under $100,000. And we've got different programs and different solutions to help everyone at every stage of it. And the thing that I really love about working with the law firms, 10, 20, 30, $40 million in revenue, is the level of humility and the level of curiosity and the level of openness to new ideas. And the thing that I find most frustrating about working with the firms around $1 million is people who get to that point and then start to develop this too cool for school attitude. And it's just so, I imagine it must be what it must be like to be a high school teacher and how frustrating that must be to work with teenagers who think they know it all. And anyway, I want to warn you, don't become one of those people. And probably none of you are that person right now, and hopefully you never will be. And just keep this in mind. All right. Let's talk about some principles, some universal principles to keep in mind as we're growing our business. And these universal principles, believe it or not, are actually going to be one of the common denominators that you're going to come back to again and again and again. And you're going to use these to think your way out of problems. And you're going to use these universal principles to think your way through challenges. And you're going to use these universal principles to discover the opportunity that is hidden within every problem. So the first universal principle is that every problem contains an equal opportunity. The bigger the opportunity, the bigger the problem it's going to come wrapped up inside of. So when you find that gigantic, overwhelming, scares the crap out of you problem, that you will eventually train yourself to react with enthusiasm, with excitement, like, hot damn, that must mean there's an amazing opportunity. Maybe I don't know what it is. Maybe I need to get some help to discover it, but I know it's there because every problem contains inside of it an equal and opposite opportunity. Universal principle number two, the principle of relativity. You get to choose what you're going to relate everything else to. You get to choose whether you see the world as problems or whether you see the world as opportunities. You get to choose whether you're going to compare yourself to people who are doing better than you or compare yourself to people who are doing worse than you, or better yet, break the habit, break the addiction of comparing yourself to other people at all. You see, anytime you compare what you're doing to someone else, it's a form of self-abuse. Because, you know, if you want to make yourself feel better, you'll find something to compare yourself to where you're doing better than someone else. Oh, look at me. I, I have a $300,000 law firm. Look at that loser with a $100,000 law firm. Oh, look at me. I've got, you know, three members of my staff. Look at that idiot who only has one member of her staff or his staff. Or if you feel particularly self-abusive on any given day, then you'll compare yourself to someone who's doing better than you. And it's completely arbitrary, right? It's a completely arbitrary comparison that you'll make. It's a completely arbitrary comparison. When you feel like propping yourself up at someone else's expense, you'll compare yourself to someone on some criteria where you judge yourself better than them. And when you want to abuse yourself or make yourself feel bad, then you'll choose to compare yourself to someone or compare your business to someone who's doing better than you. I think I said that the other way around, but y'all get my point. We have participants in this boot camp whose law firms are in the first stage of growth. We have participants in this boot camp whose law firms are in the second stage of growth, the third stage of growth. I don't think we have anyone whose law firms are beyond the third stage of growth. But we're all going to be respectful of each other, and we're all going to be respectful of the fact that that we all are ahead or behind on some criteria. Some of you may have more gross revenue than another. Some of you may have less gross revenue but higher profit margins than another. Some of you may have the profit margins, the gross revenue might not be there, but maybe your law firm can work for weeks and weeks and weeks without you having to be there. And that's something where, you know, everyone else can learn from your example. The point I'm making is there's always a criteria that you can use to make yourself feel better. There's always a criteria that you could use to make yourself feel worse. And I want to encourage everyone to just break the habit of comparing the performance of your law firm to any other law firm, at least for this boot camp. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't use benchmarks. That doesn't mean that we don't look at best practices. That doesn't mean that we don't, you know, that we don't take inspiration from creative and valuable things that other people are doing with their firms that we hadn't thought of before. But just don't go around comparing yourself. I think you all get the idea. Your law firm will be much better for it. Okay. Universal principle, the law of rhythm. Things go up, things go down. 1 minute you're on top, 1 minute you're on bottom. This month you have a flush cash flow month and you got a lot of extra cash. Next month you have an unexpected expense or an unexpected opportunity that requires financial investment and cash is tight. As you grow your firm will naturally, predictably go through different stages of profitability. Sometimes you're in a revenue range and growing at a trajectory where your margins will be very thick and it'll be the land of milk and honey and you got lots of spare cash and everything's great. And then you'll start entering the next phase of growth and the margins will get thinner and you might be a little cash tight for a little while. And understand that this is just the rhythm of growing a business. It's natural. This is part of the entrepreneurial maturity that we all get to develop, and we all must develop in the process of growing our law firm, growing our businesses through the six stages of growth that we're going to be talking about in just a few minutes. Don't let it freak you out. Don't let it scare you. If you know it's coming, you can plan for it. If you know it's coming, you can slow it down and stock up on cash before you enter the phase where things are going to be tight, and you can get your momentum going so you can get through the stages where things are tight more quickly and not have to hang out there for longer than necessary. And so we can get to the next stage where things become better. All right. Oh, someone just texted or put on there, you're on level 4. Good. Congratulations. That's great. I mean that sincerely. That's fantastic. Because that means your law firm is helping more people. That's why it's at that stage. All right. So let's talk about the 7 main parts of a law firm, the 6 stages of growth, the overview of this crash course, and get to some lessons and homework, and then Q&A. All right, and also some housekeeping. Let me do the housekeeping first, because that way I won't forget. Housekeeping is that these calls are going to take place every Tuesday from 3 o'clock till about 6 o'clock. They're going to be about 3 hours long. I have about an hour long lesson each week. This one will go a little bit longer. And then we have about an hour and a half to 2 hours of Q&A. We also have it's your responsibility to raise your hand. You're all adults. You've all made an investment to be here. I'm not going to be like a grade school teacher calling on you. If you choose to take advantage of the resources you have invested in, then you will profit from that. If you choose to hide out or not take advantage of the resources that you've invested in, well, that's your prerogative also. I'm not here to force you to drink the water that I'm leading you to. All right. We will have a private members only discussion forum. The private members only discussion forum, I'm typing it into the thing. It's going to be www.howtomanageasmalllawfirm.com/course. howtomanageasmalllawfirm.com/course. That's where you'll get everything you need for this course. You'll get the homework assignments there. You'll be able to download and listen to the homework. You'll get the you'll get access to the private members only discussion forum. Me and my team will be monitoring that private members only discussion forum. That's not the same members only discussion forum that our 400 members have access to. You don't have access to that yet because they're talking about things that I don't want to distract you with, and you're going to have questions that I don't want to distract them with. So this is just for the 40 or 50 of us that are in this boot camp today, in this private discussion forum. The point I'm making is it's monitored. We're on there all the time. And also, because of the pandemic and extenuating circumstances, we'll probably organize some pandemic-specific Q&A times to talk about tactics related to the pandemic. I will tell you this, that out of our 400 members, most of them are really, really experiencing a lot of very positive things going on in their law firms directly related to the pandemic and all of the opportunities that it is creating for their law firms to be of service. And part of the reason why they're getting so many opportunities to be of service is because so many lawyers and so many law firms are just shirking their professional responsibility and just throwing up their hands and quitting. There's all kinds of great opportunities that are coming our way. Volin, check with Stephanie and find out if there's a password to enter the site. I don't know. Volin, you'll find out and you'll put it in the discussion thing, okay?
Yes, we'll do.
All right. I don't know if there's a password because I just my computer automatically logged me in, so I've never had to enter a password. Anyway, that's the housekeeping. Every call, 3 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It'll go about 3 hours. It's your responsibility to raise your hand. Volin, tell everyone how to raise their hand. There's a way to raise your hand on Zoom. I think there's a little button you can click that says raise hand. And if you're on the phone, star nine on the phone. So star nine to raise hand for Q&A. I just posted that on the thing so everyone knows. Or you can, there's a little button on the bottom of your Zoom that you can press to raise your hand. All right.
Also, Arjun, just for everybody's information, the password you were asking for earlier is business plan. I typed it into the
chat. Is it cap sensitive?
From I see just the first B is capital.
All right. So there you go, business plan. Let's get to it. The seven main parts of a law firm. These are the seven main parts of the firm that we're going to be focusing on in the next 4 weeks to build your business plan around. First, let me preface by saying my definition of a successful law firm. If you get excited about this definition of a successful law firm, then we're going to get along great, and you're going to get tremendous value from this 4 weeks. And you'll want to take advantage of the free. Oh yeah, we have other housekeeping. We have normally at the end of this 4 week boot camp, we have a free bonus 2 day live event. A free bonus 2 day live event that should have taken place April 23rd. 22nd or 24th and 25th outside of Atlanta, but obviously because of the pandemic, that will not be happening. So the live bonus event, we may schedule it to take place sooner, but at the very latest, it will take place on Friday, October 23rd. And Saturday, October 24th, depending on what happens with the pandemic, depending on how travel restarts, we might schedule something to take place sooner than that. But at the very least, October 23rd, October 24th, put on your calendar, and you'll want to take advantage of that. That is a bonus, and not part of this 4 week boot camp. It's a bonus that you get for being here. It's free. It's extra. It's an extra bonus, but you don't have to pay for it. It's free. All right, the seven main parts of a law firm. Financial, number one, the law firm has to serve you financially. That means net income. How much net income does the law firm need to produce for you in order for you to live the way you want to live? Now, I have posed this question to thousands and thousands and thousands of lawyers over the past 20 years. And I frequently get an answer to a different question. So I want to be sure that I'm being extremely clear. The question is, how much net income does it take, we'll say before taxes, for you to live the way you want to live? The question that people answer sounds similar, but it's a very different question. The question that people answer is, how much will you settle for? The question they answer is, how much do you need to get by? The question they answer is a list of things they can do without. That's not the question that I'm asking you. Very important to get this question right. The question is, how much does it cost to live the way you want to live? What house do you want to live in? What car do you want to drive? What education do you want to provide for your children? What support do you want to provide for your extended family? What kind of vacations do you want to take? What kind of domestic services do you want to employ? What kind of insurance do you want to purchase to protect your family? Life insurance, disability insurance, et cetera. What kind of philanthropic causes do you want to support, and at what levels? How do you want to be living your life? And then after you've defined how you want to be living your life, then put a number to it. Do not do what most people do. What most people do is they start off by saying, well, I don't really need, it's not the question. The question is not, what do you need? And they'll say, well, I can settle for. The question is not, what can you settle for? They say, well, I don't really need, I could do without. The question is not, what can you do without? There's a whole lot of things that I promise you, you can do without but it wouldn't help anyone in the world for you to do without those things. There's no one on the planet who's going to be better off because you don't live in a house you want to live in. There's no one who's going to be better off because you don't drive the car you want to drive. There's no one who's going to be better off because you don't give your children the education you want to provide for them. There's a long list of people who will be better off if you are living in the house you want to live in. There's a long list of people who will be better off if you're driving the car you really want to be driving. There's a long list of people who will be better off, not least of which is your children, who will be better off if you're providing the kind of education for your children that you want to provide for your children. For the simple fact that, remember the original, where we started this whole conversation, law firms generate revenue by helping more people. So all things being equal, if you want to live in a house, if you want to live in a $250,000 house, you only have to help half as many people as if you want to live in a $500,000 house. If you want to live in a $500,000 house, you only have to help half as many people as if you decide you want to live in a $1 million house. Now, let's be clear. I personally don't give a shit where you live. I really don't. I don't care where you live. I don't care what car you drive in. I don't even care whether you give your children an education or not. They're not my children. And respectfully, I don't know you. Maybe someday I will know you. Maybe one day I'll get to really care about you. Maybe one day I'll even get to know your children and I'll care about them and I'll have a strong opinion about the education you provide for them. But right now, I don't give a shit. What I do care about is that you're honest with yourself. Self-honesty is at the core of every successful law firm, and lack of self-honesty is at the core of most problems that most law firms experience. So if you want to live in a $1 million house, great. Then let's figure out how to make a law firm that helps enough people in enough ways and runs efficiently enough so that you can afford to live in a $1 million house if that's what you want. But make no mistake about it. I am not trying to push you into a $1 million house. I'm not trying to push you into driving a fancy car. I'm not trying to push you into taking fancy vacations if that's not what you truly, honestly, sincerely, in your heart of hearts, really want. I just want you to be honest with yourself because I want to build a business. I want to build a business based on goals that are going to matter to you. We've got to get goals that matter to you. By the way, I'm teaching you a valuable lesson here about selling legal services, and I'm teaching you a valuable lesson here about managing staff effectively. It's all about helping people get clear about what matters to them. Matters to them enough to perform better than they would be performing if the goal didn't matter to them. Matters enough to them that they're willing to step outside their comfort zone more than they would be willing to step out their comfort zone to achieve something that doesn't matter to them. You can figure out, if you can help a client get clear about what matters to them, you're gonna have a much easier time converting them from a prospective client into a paying client, and you're gonna have a much easier time servicing that client the entire term of the engagement and for the lifetime of your firm's relationship with that person. If you can help members of your staff get clear about what really truly matters to them, you're going to have a much easier time managing them, coaching them, and helping them perform at their highest potential. That's a little bit of a foreshadowing for topics we're going to be getting into in the weeks ahead, but everything is a little bit connected to everything else, so it all sort of fits together. You'll see. The first part of a successful law firm is it has to serve your financial goals. It has to give you enough income to live the way you want to live. Second is personal. It has to serve you personally. It has to give you enough time to enjoy your life. If you make millions of dollars, but you never have any time to enjoy your life with your family and never have any time to pursue other passions and never have time to attend to your health and to be a part of your family, I don't consider that to be a successful law firm. It might financially be making a lot of money, but it's not a successful business if it consumes, chews up, and spits out your personal life as the price you pay for the financial success. In order to be a successful business, it must serve your financial goals and also your personal goals and also your professional goals. But in order to be a successful law firm, as far as I'm concerned, it must also help you make a positive impact in the world. If the law firm is not helping you make a positive impact in the world, I don't consider it to be a successful business. It might financially be very lucrative. It might personally be very fun and easy, but I don't consider it to be a successful law firm if it's not being used to make a positive impact in the world, at least in a way that matters to you. Also, I will tell you that having worked with thousands and thousands and thousands of law firms and law firm owners, that if your law firm is not being used to make a positive impact in the world, I find it's difficult to sustain the momentum. It's difficult to get the owner of a law firm to stand back up after he or she gets knocked on their ass, which will happen. If it doesn't really matter to you that your law firm is making an important difference in the world, you're not going to get back up when life knocks you on your ass. If you are committed to achieving and making the world a better place and using your business as a vehicle to make the world a better place, then getting knocked on your ass is merely a temporary condition, not a permanent situation. How to manage a small law firm exists for the purpose of proving a point to the world. I'm sorry if you all thought that I was here for altruistic reasons. I'm not. How to manage a small law firm exists because I have this burning, consuming, compulsive need to prove a point to the world. And the point that I have this compulsive need to prove to the world is that businesses make a profit by making people's lives better. And the better we make people's lives, the more successful our businesses can be. And I have a compulsive need to prove that the doctrine of sacrifice is self-defeating and dangerous. My business exists to expose and crush the doctrine of sacrifice, to help people recognize and see how self-defeating and dangerous the doctrine of sacrifice is. The doctrine of sacrifice, in case you don't know about it, is this idea that we should take pride in how much we suffer. Why should we take pride in how much we suffer? The doctrine of sacrifice says we should take pride in how much we sacrifice. I only think I should make a sacrifice if I'm doing so to get something better. Why would I sacrifice something precious in my life to get something that's worse? I only want to sacrifice something that I value less to get something else that I value even more. Now, the thing that I value less might be precious to me. I'm going to sacrifice 3 hours of time that I could spend with my beautiful son to be on the phone teaching all of you how to have a better life. The time with him is precious. But I'm making that sacrifice in order to create a better world for him to live in, macro and micro. You see, I'm trading off something I value less, even though it's precious to me, to get something I value more, which is a better world for him and me and all of us to live in. The doctrine of sacrifice says, no. You should just take pride in the sacrifice itself, irrespective of whether or not it produces any profit. In fact, the doctrine of sacrifice in the legal industry says that if the sacrifice creates a profit or a benefit for you, then it somehow reduces the nobility of the sacrifice. Well, where that leads you down a road where the only sacrifices that get valued are sacrifices of the precious for that which you don't value, and any sacrifice of the precious or the low value to get something of more value is somehow demeaned and undermined and criticized. as you can see, I get worked up about this. This is something I feel very strongly about. I've written extensively about it. I've spoken extensively about it for the legal industry and beyond. My business exists to expose and crush the doctrine of sacrifice. And the way that I do that is by building hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of wildly successful law firms. Because when I produce hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of the most successful law firms in the country with lawyers from all different walks of life and all different practice areas, then when the legal establishment says that you have to sacrifice for nothing, and when they say you can't have a successful law firm without suffering, we just have overwhelming, incontrovertible proof that what they're saying is complete and total bullshit. So if you understand that this is my goal, this is my mission, this is why I'm doing, this is my business has to achieve this goal professionally in order for me to consider it to be a successful business. It's not enough to achieve my financial goals. It's not enough for me to work, for me to achieve my personal goals. I'm really driven to make this professional impact on the world. Now, the good news for all of you is that I need to help you join our tribe as owners of very successful law firms that serve you financially and serve you personally and serve you professionally. All right, now we all understand what a successful business is according to me. It serves you financially, it serves you personally, and it serves you professionally. When you can get clear about that, when you find the courage to get clear about that and to put that in writing, it will create a power in your business that will make you unstoppable. And that's why we do this in the first week of our 4-week boot camp together. And if you later decide to engage our services and we become the CEO or the COO and or the CFO of your law firm for you to help you grow your law firm beyond, you'll go through a 12-week crash course, which is an expanded version of this 4-week course, and we'll still come back to this fundamental foundation of why are you doing this? Why does it matter to you enough so that when you get knocked on your ass, you will consider that to be a temporary situation instead of a permanent condition. All right. The seven main parts of a law firm. The seven main parts of a law firm are marketing. Marketing is everything that we do to bring the right kind of prospective new clients to the right place at the right time in the right frame of mind, already preconditioned and with a bias already in place to hire or engage your law firm. Marketing is everything we do to bring the right kind of prospective clients to the right place at the right time with the right frame of mind, already pre-qualified, already preconditioned with a bias to engage your law firm before they even get to the meeting with the sales team. That's marketing. And we're going to be teaching you about how to create a marketing machine that does that consistently, predictably, reliably, day in, day out, week in, week out, month in and month out, so that you don't have to always be so reactionary, knowing, so you'll know that if this prospective new client who comes to see you isn't the right kind of client, or it could be a great person, but maybe the wrong kind of case, you don't need to feel pressure to take the case because you'll know that your marketing machine will be delivering more at-bats for you in the next day, in the next week, in the next month, very consistently, predictably, reliably. That's marketing. The job of a good marketing system is equally to screen out and protect you and your team from having to meet with the wrong kinds of clients or meeting with the right kind of client, but they've got the wrong kind of case, or it's the right kind of client with the right kind of case, but they're just not far enough through their educational process to be in a position to be able to actually make an intelligent, rational decision. So you want to protect yourself, and the marketing system needs to not only attract the right kind of clients and the right quantity to the right place in the right frame of mind, but it also needs to protect you from meeting with the wrong kind of clients or the wrong kind of cases, or from great people with great cases who are just not ripe yet. They're not ready to make a decision yet, because you can wear yourself out and you can wear your team out talking to those kinds of people. That's marketing, and we're going to be covering that in this 4-week workshop and helping you map out at least a very basic marketing system that you can replicate and build on in the months and years ahead. So you'll definitely get something that's basic that you can start with. Second main part of the law firm is sales. Sales is everything that gets done in a systematic, organized, replicable, trackable, measurable way that converts prospective new clients into paying clients. Sales is everything that gets done to systematically, predictably, reliably, in a measurable way, convert prospective clients into paying clients. So marketing is, the job of marketing is to bring people to the door, and sales is, the job of sales is to greet them at the door and help them make a decision about whether it makes sense for them and makes sense for you to enter into a relationship with your firm. That's the job of sales. I'm going to be teaching you in this 4 weeks how to do sales in a very systematic, predictable, reliable way. When you learn to do sales in this way, it will reduce your stress. It will reduce your pressure. It will reduce your anxiety. Maybe not the first or second or third time you do it, because it's going to be a new way of doing things. Anytime you do something new, you can anticipate it's going to be a little bit awkward and uncomfortable. But I think you'll see very quickly, and you'll recognize right away, that this will be a less stressful, less adversarial approach to meeting with prospective new clients and converting them into paying clients. It's much more profitable, I would argue, and I think you'll all see that it's much more professional. I think it's way more ethical than the way most law firms are out there trying to convert prospective clients into paying clients. And some of you may already be very skilled at this particular approach, this methodology for selling professional services, and you'll be ready to go very quickly to the next phase where we can hire non-attorneys to actually meet with our prospective clients and convert them into paying clients, even when we're not there, even when you're on vacation, even when you're away from the firm for 30 consecutive days with emergency access only. That's part of the way that you create a business that works without you having to be there month in and month out, is by training other people. And I think you'll see the logic of why those other people should be non-attorneys to meet with your prospective clients and convert them from prospective clients into paying clients. We're going to be covering that also during this 4-week bootcamp. The third main part of every successful law firm, which, by the way, it's also part of every unsuccessful law firm. The difference between an unsuccessful law firm and a successful law firm is not the existence or absence of any of these seven main parts. Instead, it's the extent to which care and attention and strategy has been applied to each of these seven main parts, and the extent to which these seven main parts are managed and kept in alignment with one another. The third main part of every successful law firm, and also the third main part of every unsuccessful law firm, is the workflow, processes, and systems and procedures. It's the factory, how the work gets done. Getting clear on what's on the menu, getting clear on what's not on the menu. when you go to a McDonald's, you don't expect to get a pizza. When you go to a Pizza Hut, you don't expect to get a cheeseburger. When you go to a Kentucky Fried Chicken, you don't expect to get a cheeseburger or a pizza. You got to be clear on what's on the menu and what's decidedly off the menu so we can build efficient workflow processes and procedures and systems so that the work can be done in a systematic, predictable, reliable, replicable, scalable way. When you see a law firm and everyone's running around crazy and the owner of the law firm can never take time away and they're always complaining about their staff or they can never hire good staff, usually you say, well, let me see your documented build sheets. Let me see your recipes. Let me see your instructions for how the work is supposed to get done. And they don't have anything like that. Everything is being reinvented every day. Everything is coming out of their own, the head of the owner. And what that does is it makes it impossible to really train people. And it makes it impossible to give people a way to earn your trust so you can truly delegate responsibility to them to take care of things. So the third main part of every successful law firm is the workflow processes and procedures. And when you take the policies and you take the procedures and you take the templates and the checklists and the samples and the examples and the instructions written in plain English on how to do everything, and you put them all together, what you get is a system. What we want is we want to have a law firm that is run on systems. Systems manage successful law firms, and people manage well-conceived systems, which brings us to the fourth part of the law firm, which is the people. Documenting job descriptions, documenting the boundaries between each of the different job descriptions. So we're clear what is and what is not the job of a receptionist, what is and what is not the job of a secretary, what is and what is not the job of a paralegal. Every law firm has the following positions on staff. Yours does too. Now, some of these people may all look like you, and some of these people may have been calling in sick for a long, long time, and you'll instantly understand why that part of the business might not be working very well. But every law firm has a receptionist, or secretary, a paralegal, an associate, a rainmaker, a manager, an owner, a CEO, a COO, a CFO, and a bookkeeper. Every law firm has these positions on staff. To the extent that everyone is clear about what each of these jobs is and clear about what each of these jobs is not, to the extent that everyone is clear about how each of these jobs needs to get done in a coordinated way that is consistent with the business plan of the law firm and the overall strategy and goals of the owner, to the extent that each of these positions is documented, the job description is documented, and we can put some measurements and some metrics and some key performance indicators in place so that we can be more objective in how we measure and evaluate the performance and the ROI that we're getting on our investments in the people in each of these positions. To the extent we do that, the people are your most valuable asset in a law firm. To the extent that you don't do that, then people just become a liability. So we've got marketing, sales, production, people, and then we got physical plant. Physical plant is all of the stuff that the firm uses. These are the tools. This is the office space, the desks, the computers, the software, the intellectual property, which includes the build sheets and the policies and the procedures and the systems. That's part of the physical plant. That's part of the intellectual property of the law firm. One of the things you're going to learn about is a piece of intellectual property, an asset that your law firm owns that most lawyers are oblivious to, that they're standing on top of there's a book written years ago called Acres of Diamonds. And most lawyers are oblivious to the fact that they're standing on top of acres with diamonds just under the surface. And we're going to show you where to find some of those acres of diamonds that you can begin to mine right away to start boosting cash flow and revenue predictability and professional satisfaction from your business. Here's a hint. It's called your client list. The list of clients that your firm has served over the past months, years, or decades is like diamonds that are mere feet under soft ground that you can dig up very quickly, very efficiently. So physical plant is the fifth of the seven main parts of your law firm. Just in case you're keeping track, there's marketing, sales. Marketing leads to sales. You do good marketing, you got opportunities to make sales. You do good sales and you have a need for production. Once people are doing production, they need stuff. That brings us to physical plant. I'm sorry, once production is needed, you need people to do it. Marketing leads to sales. Sales leads to production. Production requires people. People require physical plant. They require stuff, intellectual property, policies, procedures, systems, checklists, templates, examples, how to, that kind of thing. The sixth main part, of course, is financial controls. We're going to cover, by the way, we're not going to cover a lot of physical plant in this 4 weeks. There's just not enough time to do justice for everything. And I'd rather get deeper into a few areas than go shallow and wide and not give you really, really a lot of meat in anything. So we're not going to cover a lot around physical plant in this four-week crash course. It's very, very important, but we just had to draw the line somewhere, and we just couldn't fit it in and do everything else justice that we felt was important to do justice. The sixth main part is financial controls. Your law firm should, and by the end of this 6 week, by the end of this 4 week crash course, you're going to understand why and how to create a 12-month forward-looking budget with revenue projections. Yes, even you contingency lawyers, we're going to teach you how to do revenue projections, and we're going to So a 12-month forward-looking budget. We're going to teach you why and how to get and interpret and analyze and make entrepreneurially mature decisions based on a budget variance report. That's where you compare what you expected was going to happen in each area of your budget with what actually happened in each area of your budget, the percentage difference, and why there was a difference, and what we should do to make small course adjustments now rather than waiting to the end of the year after it's too late to do anything about it. Budget, 12-month forward-looking budget. Budget variance report, comparison of what we expected each month against what actually happened. Cash flow projections. You're going to learn why and how to create a 6-week cash flow projection so that every week you're looking 6 weeks ahead, week by week by week by week by week by week, so you can anticipate problems before they land on your doorstep and blow up in your face. Because when you're looking at a 6-week cash flow projection every single week, you can be proactive instead of reactive. Budget variance report, cash flow projection. We're going to teach you how to make smart business decisions regarding your AR report. Your cash position in your operating account and your trust account, and your work in process report, your WIP report, so you can project how much work will be billable in the month and 2 months leading up. And we're also going to cover some key metrics and key performance indicators and talk about how to create a dashboard for your law firm so that at a glance, you can see what's going right, what's going wrong, and we'll actually give you access to a proprietary dashboard that we created several years ago that it powers hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of our members' law firms that they use to see what's going on in their business. These are the seven main parts of the law firm. The seventh part are your goals, your financial goals, your personal goals, and your professional goals. I need to take one quick little break and change to a different Bluetooth headset, because this one is dying. So hold on 1 second.
Hey guys, just in the meantime, this is Volan, Amar John's executive assistant. I'll be helping him out on these calls. In the meantime, can we just test out a couple of you putting your arm up? Try raising your hand so we could call you later for the Q&A. All right, got Kerry Garcia, John Howell. All right, got it. Thank you, guys.
Okay, I think I'm back, and I think you can all hear me now. Can someone type in, Volan, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. You're back.
Volan. Okay, I'm back. Great. Sorry, everyone. I've been burning through Bluetooth all week, last week and this week, and I accidentally got cut off as I switched from one Bluetooth to the other. I apologize. So let's get to it. So I talked about the seven main parts of every successful law firm. Let's talk about the six stages of growth, and then we're going to get to the homework, and we'll do some Q&A. The six stages of growth very quickly are: stage one is with gross revenues of zero to about $250,000 gross revenue. In stage one, it's all about hustle, market, sell. You really don't have a whole lot of leverage. Most of it's 100% on your back and on your shoulders, which is why it seems so overwhelming and difficult, because quite candidly, or just quite, it's very simple. You can't afford to buy a whole lot of leverage. It's just that simple. On a $250,000 law firm, you're only grossing less than $20,000 a month, and you're just not going to be able to hire a whole lot of people to help you. Go and put everyone on mute. So that's why the first stage of growth is such a slog. And the challenge is if you spend too much time in that first stage of growth, you kind of get stuck there, and it wears you down, and you start coming up with stories and excuses and rationalizations and justifications, and pretty soon you're just like stuck, and it's like you just got to get through it. It's like there's a song, if you're going through hell, you better keep on going. You might just get through before the devil even knows you were there. That's kind of what the first stage of growth is. We want to power through it as fast as we can. Now, if you've been in that first stage of growth, zero to $250,000 in gross revenue for more than a few years, one of the things that we may have to work on in this 4-week course is to help break you free of some of the stories and break you free of some of the habits that have been keeping you stuck. But I promise you, once we get you unstuck, we regularly take firms from zero to $250,000 in revenue in 18 months from start to finish. We regularly take firms from $250,000 to $500,000, boom, another 18 months. It's not that complicated. It just requires you to be willing to do things that are new and different and probably very much outside your comfort zone, because you've gotten comfortable doing things the way you've been doing them, which is why you keep getting the results you keep getting in your law firm. So the first stage of growth, zero to $250,000. One of the things that's very challenging sometimes when you're going from zero to, from the first stage of growth to the second stage of growth, I'm just going to warn you, is The second stage of growth is all about beginning to buy your freedom. You're going to begin to buy your freedom by hiring people to liberate you from doing things that previously you were doing yourself, right? And, you know, what that is going to mean is that at least for a little while, your profit margins will actually be less because you're buying your freedom. So you might be grossing $250,000, and out of $250,000, you might be able to put $200,000 of it into your pocket. And then we come along and say, look, you got to hire, you know, to get to the next stage of growth, if you want to, you're going to have to hire an associate. The associate better not be a helper. They really should be a replacement. It should be someone who is as good of a lawyer as you are, if not better. So you don't just saddle yourself with another job of having to mentor some wet behind the ears lawyer who doesn't know his ass from a hole in the ground. You want to hire, you can't afford to hire a helper in the beginning. You got to hire a replacement, someone who's as good as you so you can truly offload things from your plate onto their plate. Well, that person's not going to come cheap. Let's say you got to pay that person $100,000 a year. Well, that's going to be $10,000 a month by the time you're done with their salary and benefits and everything else. Well, we're, you know, that means you got to really engineer the job to be profitable right from the beginning. So you're going to have to work some extra hours to engineer that job. We're going to have to gain some momentum and build up some work in reserve so that as soon as the person hits the ground, 2 weeks later, they're taking things off your plate because we hired a grown-up, and they start making a profit for you by the second month. But that first month, profits are a little bit thin because you're having to invest in buying your freedom. And this is a big reason why a lot of lawyers don't ever make the switch from having a practice to having a sustainable business. In the second stage of growth, which is typically around $250,000 to around $500,000, and these are arounds and abouts, it's not exact, around $250,000 to around $500,000, the name of the game is all about learning to run your business through a team. You're building a team. You're hiring people. You're making mistakes in hiring people and then having to let them go and hire someone else so you learn from your mistakes. I can teach you everything. I can tell you every mistake to avoid. I can tell you every right thing to do to not make hiring mistakes. And I promise you, you're still going to make them because it's just the way it is. Some things you're just going to have to experience on your own. I don't want you to come to How to Manage a Small Law Firm with the idea being that we're going to prevent you from ever making mistakes. Instead, I want you to come to us with the idea being that we're going to prevent you from making the worst mistakes. And we're going to help you recover from your mistakes much faster. And we're going to make things, we're going to make the bad things less bad. We're going to make the good things better. We're going to help you recover from the mistakes faster. And we're going to help you leverage the good things quicker too. That's the way to think of it. From $250,000 to $500,000 in gross revenue, it's all about beginning to build your team. Beginning to build a team that you can depend on so that you can think longer term, so you can think more strategically and not get bogged down in all the tactics. So you can begin to delegate things and have some freedom to really think about the future instead of living day by day and fighting, you know, fighting the small battles on a day by day, week by week basis in your law firm. The third stage of growth is the long one. The third stage of growth is the longest. You got to be really ready for it. It's between $500,000 in gross revenue all the way up to $1.5 million. You notice the first stage of growth was only $250,000. The second stage of growth was only $250,000 from $250,000 to $500,000. That's only $250,000 growth. This third stage of growth, this is the big one. This is the hard one. This is the one that goes from $500,000 all the way up to $1.5 million. We're quadrupling the firm. We're going from 500 to $1.5 million. It's $1 million worth of gross revenue growth. And this is all about learning how to run your business by the numbers, learning to trust your instruments, learning to use a dashboard, you're learning to use metrics, learning to make quicker, more confident decisions based on financials, based on metrics, based on dashboard. Learning how to manage your team by the numbers so that it's not so much of a, I feel this, I feel that, but rather the data, the metrics, the analytics are telling me that this is true, even if it doesn't feel that way. This is where you start getting to the point where you're like, wow, you know, Bob is my favorite associate and Mary is my least favorite associate. But the data shows me that Mary is much more profitable for my business than Bob. Therefore, Mary is a better associate to invest in than Bob. This is where you start looking at your marketing with numbers. I like this kind of marketing, but the data is showing me that that kind of marketing gives me a better ROI. So irrespective of what I like, I'm going to do what the data is showing me is actually better. This is the most uncomfortable part of the entire process. It's like, this is where you learn how to kind of take your hands off the wheel and let the thing drive itself by the data. This is where a lot of entrepreneurial growth takes place. And this is where a lot of people fail to grow, refuse to grow, and they tend to stall out. And the danger zone is around $900,000. $900,000 is the danger zone. $900,000 to $999,000 is the danger zone of where you'll see law firms stalling out in this third stage of growth. Now, you get to around $1.5 million, and around $1.5 million, that's where if we are functioning as the COO of your law firm for you to help you grow it up to $1.5 million. And by the way, we can get most law firms from around $0 in revenue to around $1.5 million in revenue in about 48 months. That's all it takes is about 48 months to take a firm from nothing to $1.5 million in gross revenue. The variable is a function of how much you fight us. If you keep fighting everything, if you keep analyzing everything to death, instead of letting everything be an experiment, let everything be a small test, and we fail forward. Let's test it, fail, move forward. Test it, fail, learn, adapt, pivot, move forward. If you can do that, we can get you from zero to about $1.5 million in gross revenue in about 48 months, pretty reliably in just about any practice area. Obviously, contingency firms are going to lag behind if we measure it on a cash basis, but you'll see it happening if we do it on an accrual basis, just the same. Around $1.5 million is when we will come to you and say, it's time for you to hire a full-time, in-house, professional legal administrator, and you have now officially outgrown our fractional timeshare COO service. It's time to leave the nest and bring in a professional legal administrator. We'll help you find that person. We won't recruit the person for you, but we will help you interview your candidates. We'll help you onboard your candidates. We will do a celebration as we transition over to that candidate. And many of our members even come to us and say, will you keep working as my COO to help manage and supervise my professional legal administrator so that I don't have to? And we do that for a number of our members too. The third stage of growth goes from about $500,000 to about $1.5 million. It's all about learning to run the business by the numbers and learning to install a professional legal administrator to run your business, the day-to-day operations of your business for you. Again, so you can think at a higher level, so you can think even more long-term, you can really think on a strategic level. And again, this is a big challenge for a lot of people who don't have a lot of experience in trusting the management of their business to another person. And believe me, I had the same experience also. Nowadays, I have a general manager. I have a director of operations. I have a director of finance. I have a director of programs. I have a director of marketing. And they run each of these different parts of my business for me. And I get to think much, much more strategically, which I promise you is a lot easier and a lot more fun. And that's where you really start to see all the opportunities to supercharge your business. And you'll really find that it's easier when you make this transition and bring in that professional legal administrator than when you're doing everything yourself. You can grow a business, you can grow a law firm pretty much on your own back, just based on your own willpower and grit and perseverance and you can grow it to around $1.5 to $2 million just on yourself. But to get it beyond that, it just gets to be too big and too unwieldy. And unless you have management experience and marketing experience and financial control experience, and even if you have those experiences, you can't be doing that with your nose down on the grindstone and also have your head up in the clouds thinking strategically long term about where you want to take the business to next. So anyway, that's the third stage of growth. So 0 to 250 is the first stage. 250 to 500 is the second stage. 500 to 1.5 million is the third stage. The fourth stage is 1.5 million to around $3 million. From 1.5 million, between 1.5 million and $3 million, it's really where you start to supercharge where you start to use the profits of your business and you use the metrics of your business and you use the dashboard of your business to make much more strategic decisions, much more long range decisions. When you get to around $3 million in revenue, by the way, you may never want to do that. You may have no aspirations to ever have a $3 million firm. You may never even have any aspirations to have a $1 million firm. And that's perfectly fine by me. I'm not going to try to push you or pressure you or cajole you that you should have a $3 million firm. I am going to try to ask you to think very seriously about the fact that life is really materially better at $1.5 million. It just, when you can bring in that professional legal administrator, things get so much better. So I'm not going to pressure you, but I am going to try to encourage you to really give that serious thought. When you get to around $3 million, you will have officially outgrown our outside fractional timeshare CFO service, and it will be time to bring in a professional management accountant as opposed to a financial accountant. And I can answer the question about the difference between a management accountant and a financial accountant later when we get to that topic in a couple of weeks. Or if someone asks the question later, I'm happy to answer it. But around $3 million, you're going to bring in a management accountant or a controller to take over what we do for you up to around $3 million with our outside fractional timeshare CFO service. So 0 to 250 is stage one, 250 to 500 is stage two, 500 to 1.5 million is stage three, 1 million to 3 million is stage four, stage five is up to around $5 million. Once you get your business to $5 million, once you get your law firm to $5 million, it begins to be not even a law firm. It is clearly a business that happens to sell legal services. You may or may not even practice law anymore. You may decide you want to just be a full-time CEO or president of your like the spokesperson and the visionary for your law firm. And depending on what decision you make there, then you go to stage six, which is beyond $5 million. In gross revenue. So those are the six stages of growth that a law firm goes through. Each of the six stages is very predictable. The challenges, the opportunities, it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like if you've got children, you know what to expect with a two-year-old, you know what to expect with a four-year-old, you know what to expect with a six-year-old, you know what to expect with a 10-year-old, you know what to expect with a 12-year-old, you know what to expect with a 15-year-old, you know what to expect. These are very predictable stages of growth that the business goes through. I want to make this very clear because every time I do this, not every time, but too often when I do this, I get people whining and complaining about, I don't want to continue working with the boot camp because I don't like the way you're telling me things have to be. I'm not telling you, this is not a prescription. I am not prescribing any of these six stages of growth. I am reporting to you 20 years of experience. This is just how it is. You are now forewarned. To be forewarned is to be forearmed, and now we can prepare you. Okay, so let's get to the lessons, and then we're going to do some Q&A, and then we're going to give you homework. Well, we already talked about setting your goals. So your one of your homework assignments for next week is to get clear on your financial goal, get clear on your personal goal, get clear on your professional goal. The financial goal is obviously the easiest, which is why we talk about it first, because it's just a number. It doesn't require a narrative. It doesn't require a story or a justification or a rationalization. We just need a number. We just need to know, and let's say 2 years from now, however old you are right now, plus 2 years, when I'm this age, when my law firm 2 years from now, I want to be living like this. This is the house I want to be living in. This is the car I want to be driving. These are the domestic services that I want to employ. These are the vacations I want to take. This is the education I want to provide for my children, if you have children. These are the charities I want to support at these levels. These are the members of my extended family I want to give support to at these levels. This is the dollar amount that it costs to live the way I want to live. It just requires a number. From that number, we will then build an entire business plan in service of that number. If you tell me that it costs $200,000 a year to live the way you want to live, and you tell, and later on we determine that, let's say your law firm will operate at, let's just say, a 20% profit margin, then that means your law firm has to gross $1 million a year. And if we determine that your average case or matter is going to be, let's just say, $5,000, then that means the firm has to be prepared to open and close 200 cases per year. That's 17 per month, not 20 per month, not 10 per month, 17 per month. And if it opens 10 this month, it better open up 7 extra next month. And if it opens up 27 this month, then it only needs to open up 10 next month. And everything is driven by this number. So if you tell me that you want to earn, that it takes $200,000 to live the way you want to live, and you say, and we determine that the firm should be operating at a 20% profit margin, I'm just making up these numbers to illustrate a point, then that means we need to have a $1 million firm. And if we figure the average case is $5,000, that means you need to open up and close 200 cases a year, which is 17 a month. And if the firm is, and if the market, and if the sales, and if the sales team is going to convert, let's just say one out of three. So one out of three prospective clients that come in to see you becomes a client of the firm. That means 17 times three, that means marketing has to deliver 51 prospective new clients per month. Marketing delivers 51 prospective clients per month. Sales converts one out of three. That gives us 17 new cases per month at an average value of $5,000, means we open and close 200 cases a year, which means we gross $1 million and we operate the firm at a 20% profit margin. That gives you your $200,000 to live the way you want to live. And everything gets based off of that number. Now, if your $200,000 number is a bullshit number, then everything we build is bullshit. Your marketing will be bullshit. Your sales projections will be bullshit. Your staffing projections will be bullshit. The amount of space we need for your bullshit staff, for your bullshit workload, for your bullshit goals, that'll be bullshit too. Now, believe me, the vast majority of law firms out there, you may not know this, but I promise you it's true, they're running bullshit businesses based on bullshit goals with bullshit plans. It's all a bunch of bullshit. And this is why you see lawyers freaking out and firing their whole staff, you know, as soon as there's any kind of an interruption to anything, because it's all based on bullshit. We're going to help you do better than that. So your homework assignment for next week is to determine how much income is required to live the way you want to live. What are your financial goals? And again, let's just say 24 months from now. Don't worry about 10 years from now. Don't tell me about 2 months from now. 24 months from now, how do you want to be living? How much does it cost to live that way? Because from that number is going to be a seed that we plant in fertile ground over the next 4 weeks, and from it will emerge an entire business plan. Don't make it a bullshit seed. I will challenge you and help you with that. Lesson number two is developing your magic statement. Now, what we mean by that is this. When you meet with prospective referral sources, be it at a networking event or at a speech or at a or at a bar function, which is sort of a networking event, or you're writing an article, or you're sitting down and meeting with a prospective new client, or you're sitting down to meet with a prospective new member of your team, everyone wants to know the answer to the same question. And if you give it a few minutes of thought, you know what this question is. And I'm going to tell you what the question is. The point is, from now on, it is inexcusable to stammer and stutter and not have a clear, compelling answer to this question when I'm telling you, and when you yourself will instantly recognize when I say the question, yeah, that is the question that everyone wants to know. The question that everyone wants to know is, it sounds like this, but this isn't really the question. It's going to sound like, what do you do? You're going to be at a networking event and they want to know, and they ask, hey, what do you do? You're going to be at a speech and the audience is like, what does this guy do? What does she do? You're going to be meeting with a prospective new employee and they want to know, what does this firm do? But that's not really the question that they want to know the answer to. The question they really want to know the answer to is, what can you do for me? So you've got to be prepared to answer the question that they really want to know the answer to, and that is, what can you do for me? What does this law firm do that can make my life better? So whenever you hear the question, what do you do, you got to sort of translate that from the polite question into the real question, and skip over all the polite conversation that they don't really care about and jump right to the heart of it and answer the question of, what can you do for them? So, and by the way, you can have different magic answers. And the reason we call it a magic answer is because I want you to imagine that a prospective new client comes to, you've done all this marketing. You've done all this social media marketing, and you've written all these articles, and you've done all this networking, and you've placed all these ads, and your intake has talked to all these people who've called your law firm about getting some help. You've done all of this marketing to result in the goal of bringing a prospective client to your office, literally or virtually in this time of pandemic. They come to your office, and I want you to imagine that in the parking lot, they see a sign. And to the left, the sign says, your law firm. And to the right, the sign says, magician. Now, all things being equal, if you're being really honest, you know that the client would rather have the magician solve their problem for them with his or her magic wand. They don't want to hire a lawyer to file a demand letter, to write a demand letter. And they don't want a lawyer to do depositions. And they don't want a lawyer to do discovery. And they don't want a lawyer to ask them a whole bunch of questions they don't know the answers to. And they don't want a lawyer to negotiate with the other side. What they want is a solution. And if the magician can wave his or her magic wand and get them that solution, you know that if they really believe that was possible, they'd all go to the magician first. and not come to your firm. So you're going to do all this marketing to bring them to the parking lot, and the magician is going to take all of your business away from you. Now, what I want you to imagine is they meet the magician, they fill out the intake sheet with the magician, they sit down in the magician's office, the magician is poised with his or her magic wand above their head, and the magician asks the question, what do you want? And the answer to that question is your magic answer. No one's going to say, I want to file a divorce. No one's going to say, I want to file bankruptcy. No one's going to say, I want to file my papers with INS and spend the next 2 years wondering what's happening. No one's going to say, I want to file a lawsuit. No one's going to say that they want any of that. What they're going to say they want is the outcome. So rather than telling people about the sausage factory, tell people about the outcome. When people ask me what I do, I will say something along the lines of, my firm helps lawyers build super successful law firms. Now, if they're not interested in building a super successful law firm, if they don't know anyone who's interested in building a super successful law firm, and that answer bounces off them like a brick wall and it goes nowhere and it falls flat, I don't care, because they weren't interested in doing business with me and they don't know anyone who might be interested in doing business with me. Maybe they'll remember that though, if and when the day ever comes that they meet someone who has an interest or a need for building a super successful small law firm. On the other hand, if I'm in a crowded restaurant and I'm at the booth next door to someone and the person I'm having dinner with says, what do you do? And I say, we help lawyers build super successful law firms. And the person at the booth next to me, or the person waiting on me, him or herself, or someone that they care about and know, has a need or an interest in building a super successful law firm, you can bet they're going to ask me to elaborate. They're going to ask me to expound. It opens the door for the conversation. And that is the magic statement. So we want to work on, when someone asks, what do? What are you going to say? All right. So we've been on this call now for 2 hours. We've hit the 2 hour mark. I promise you, next week and the future weeks, the lesson will be much more, much shorter, and we'll have much more time for Q&A. This time I had to do a big introduction. So we've got time for Q&A right now. So Volin, remind everyone how to raise their hand on the Zoom, or how to raise their hand if they're on the phone. I know if you're on the phone, I think you press *9. So press *9 to raise your hand. And if you, and if you're on the Zoom, press the other thing. And I want to help you get clear on your financial goals. And I want to help you get clear on your magic statement. And I'm happy to help you with anything else that you want help with. *9 to raise your hand.
Click and the raise your hand button on Zoom.
All right.
First we have Nick, and then FYI guys, you guys are popping up kind of in order of who presses here on my screen, and I'm just going to keep in track, and I'm just going to answer starting with the earliest, going back to the latest. I'm going to unmute you before, I'm going to call your name, then unmute you. First we have Nick Pasalacqua. I'm sorry if I didn't say it correctly.
Don't say the last name, just Nick.
Got it. Nick, you're unmuted.
All right, thanks. Arjan, thanks. Just a quick question. I just printed out the workbook for this week. Do you want us working through those 10, 12 pages of homework that's in that packet?
Yeah, the idea is do the homework and come to the next call with questions.
Gotcha. That was my only point of clarification for that.
Yeah, the idea, everyone, is that you do the work, and then you come to the next call, and I help you with your answers. So if you get stuck on a question, bring it to the next call. If you just want help coming up with other ideas and creative solutions and maybe a creative way of looking at it, that 20 years of answering the same question over and over and over and over again might help you, that's what you do. Your job is to stay 1 week ahead of us on the homework.
Great.
And then if you decide to take advantage of the bonus at the end, the live meeting, it's basically 2 days of taking every question and every assignment and really just unpacking it over 2 days together live for two whole days to really just kind of redo the whole thing in a much more depth and a lot more personal attention than we can do in this setting. All right. Next.
Up next, we have Carrie. Carrie, you are unmuted.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for taking my question. I am in stage one of this process. I'm discovering that just hearing Arjun speak. And Arjun, I know you talked about this kind of pipeline of marketing, sales, workflow, people, et cetera, et cetera. Does that mean that we shouldn't really be thinking about hiring someone in stage one? Or do you think that that's something we should start thinking about in those early stages?
That's such a great question, Carrie. So I got to be really careful in the way I answer this. Can you hear me okay, by the way? My Bluetooth died and I put it on speakerphone.
I hear you, yeah.
Okay. It's such a great question, and I wish more people would ask this question. If you were my best friend, if I knew you personally really well, I would tell you, hire someone as soon as you possibly can. I would tell you, eat ramen noodles if that's what you have to do to hire someone to buy your freedom. Because there's a whole bunch of stuff that you're going to end up doing yourself that you really, that's not the highest and best use of your time. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, like, I would hire someone right away if I could. As soon as you can, I'd be hiring someone to be your executive assistant. Even if it's a virtual person, even if they're only available 10 hours a week, get your calendar, get your scheduling, get all the time you waste trying to track down appointments and track people down and coordinate meetings and all that stuff. I mean, if you could pay someone $20 an hour for 10 days, for 10 hours a week, that's only $200 a week, right? And what are you generating per hour?
As far as my hourly rate or as far as what I would bill that person at? Oh, my hourly rate's $250.
Yeah, forget about billing this person. You're not going to bill this person for anything. This is just your assistant. This is just the person who's making the appointment for your dog at the veterinarian. This got nothing to do with billing anyone for anything. This is a matter of buying your freedom. How many hours a week do you spend screwing around with a bunch of bullshit that's just scheduling appointments, tracking things down, buying airfare, booking hotels, tracking down a gift for a friend? I mean, just crap like that. You probably spend, 10 hours a week on stuff like that?
Yeah.
Okay, so if you could – more. Okay, well, let's even just say it's 10 because I can't do complicated math. If you spend 10 hours a week doing stuff like that and you're capable of billing $250 an hour, that means that it's costing you $2,500 a week in opportunity cost. And if you can pay someone $20 an hour for 10 hours a week, that's only $200 in expense. That means you're netting $2,300 in profit. You following where I'm coming from?
I am.
Now, someone will say, yeah, Arjun, but I don't have enough work to do. Well, okay, then that even just underscores my point even more. Because if you can pay someone $200 an hour, I mean, sorry, $200 a week to free you up for 10 hours a week, and you invest those 10 hours a week on marketing, 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 and marketing, you're going to have 10 hours a week of billables pretty soon, right?
Right.
But instead what people do is they're penny wise and they're pound idiotic about this. Right? And they think they're being responsible, but in truth they're being anything but responsible. It's the most irresponsible thing in the world to take a $250 asset and trade it in for a $20 savings. Isn't that stupid? Isn't that irresponsible? Can you think of anything more irresponsible for a business owner to do than to take a $250 asset and trade it in for $20 savings?
Not when you say it that way.
That was a trick question, because the answer is yes. You could take the $250 asset and trade it in for a $10 savings, which they do also. Hire a housekeeper. Hire a maid. What are you doing your laundry for? How many hours do you spend doing housework that you could pay someone $10 or $12 an hour for? They'd be thrilled to have the work. You wouldn't have to do it. And you could, you know, if you want to spend the time doing marketing, do marketing. If you want to spend the time doing sales, do sales. If you want to spend the time just being a spouse or a parent, invest the time being a spouse or a parent. But don't sit there telling your clients out of one side of your face that you value your time at $250 an hour, and then out of the other side of your face, doing $10, $12, $20 an hour work.
Makes sense.
Did I answer your question?
I think you more than answered my question. I appreciate it. I think I know what I need to do. So thank you.
Yeah. Start firing yourself. Start buying your freedom. Use money for what entrepreneurs understand money is used for. You see, blue collar workers, and I come from a blue collar background, so I get this. Blue collar workers, the only asset they have is time. And they trade their one asset for the only thing they need, which is money. And they trade their time for money, time for money, time for money, time for money. And if you're making $20 an hour and you need to pay a mechanic $20 an hour to fix your car, you might as well fix your car yourself, for example. If you're only making $20 an hour and you're going to pay a maid $20 an hour to clean your house, you might as well save the money and do it yourself. It's like you're paying yourself the same $20 an hour. You follow?
Yeah.
That's the mindset of a blue-collar worker. That is the world in which blue-collar workers exist. And like I said, I come from a blue-collar background. I respect that. I understand that. But at some point, we have to acknowledge the fact that we're not blue-collar workers anymore. Now, white-collar workers can trade their time for hundreds of dollars an hour, which is the conversation you and I just had.
Right.
But when you can trade your time for hundreds of dollars an hour, it creates all kinds of unhealthy behaviors. And the unhealthy behaviors that get caused are they start trading their time for self-esteem. They start trading their time for appreciation. So I'll work for free for a client because I want the client to like me. I'll work for free because I want the client to value me and appreciate me. And because I know I'll never actually starve, and I know I'll never actually be homeless, and I know I'll never actually have to tell my children there's no food, because anytime that things get really, really, really tough, I can take all my excuses and shove them up my ass and go start generating hundreds of dollars per hour. I can afford to be very, very inefficient and sloppy and self-indulgent and trade my time for self-esteem. Is any of that resonating with you at all? Maybe even a little bit?
A lot of it, yeah.
Okay.
Feel like you're talking now, directly about me, yeah.
Now, there's an episode, Voland, you're going to find it, and you're going to post it on the forum for me. There's an episode where I interviewed one of our members. I believe it was Jessica. Vanessa. I believe it was Vanessa Vasquez. I interviewed her on the radio show, Real Lawyers, Real Problems, Real Life Stories, and I had this conversation with her. I think it was her, Bolin. Double check with me and Stephanie to make sure. where we had like a real long in-depth conversation about this concept, and you'll all want to listen to that. But the third level is, you know, you go from blue collar workers who trade their time for money to white collar workers who generally trade their time for self-esteem and appreciation and acceptance and approval. When you become an entrepreneur, you realize that the balance sheet is very, very different, because you'll notice that the blue collar worker has on the left side, on the asset side, is their time. The white collar worker has on the asset side, on the left side, their time. To the entrepreneur, we have on the left side of the balance sheet is money. And we use money to buy speed. We use money to buy shortcuts. We use money to buy efficiency. That's what each and every one of you is doing here today. You're investing some money to buy years of experience at a discount. You're spending $1,000 to get 20 years of experience to avoid tons and tons of painful, expensive, time-consuming mistakes. What a bargain you're getting, right? As an entrepreneur, we look at our money and we see the money is an asset, and the only real use for it is to buy speed, to buy efficiency, to buy expertise, to buy experience, and to buy shortcuts, so we don't have to learn all the expensive, painful, time-consuming mistakes that someone else is willing to sell us for a bargain. Is this changing your perspective a little bit, I hope?
Is, and I guess the only concern that I would have as a follow-up is, are these uncertain coronavirus times the right time to make that move, or does that change your answer at all?
It does not change my answer one bit.
Okay.
Why would it change my answer? This is a principle of business that has been around for 1,000 years. And as far as I can tell, it's not going to change for the next 1,000 years.
Okay. I guess I asked only because the economy is uncertain, and perhaps, you know, we don't know.
The economy is not uncertain.
Okay.
Carrie, you've got to understand the economy is not uncertain. The economy is very certain. The playbook has been written and tested and used many times before. Everyone who knows the history of economics, everyone who knows the history of the business and the legal industry, we all know what's going to happen next. It's not uncertain for us. What kind of law do you do, Carrie?
Family law.
Family law. Okay. So imagine a client comes to you and they've never been through a divorce before, and everything is scary and everything is unfamiliar, and they consider everything to be uncertain. And they bring you a fact pattern that you've seen like hundreds of times before, and you're in front of a judge who you've been in front of dozens of times before, and you're going up against opposing counsel who you've been up against many times before. What exactly is uncertain about how this case is going to unfold?
Right, and that's you here now. You're that person, I get it.
Listen, I've never been through a divorce before. I would be the client saying, this is uncertain. You would be the experienced family law attorney saying, Arjun, this is not uncertain. This is very predictable. This is the way the game is played. This is how it works. This is what you can expect. They're going to do this. We're going to do that. We're going to do this. They're going to do that. The judge is going to say this. The judge is going to say that. And this is how it's all going to go down. And I'm going to say, okay, well, good thing that I'm buying efficiency. Good thing that I'm buying experience. Good thing that I'm buying speed. Good thing that you're willing to sell me your years and years and years of experience at a great discount relative to what you paid for it. Right?
Right.
What's going to happen in the economy is extremely predictable. Everyone who knows economics knows what comes next. What's going to come next is the economy is going to tank, and it's going to tank badly. And it's going to tank badly when the next quarterly earning reports come out. And here's why. Let's say you're the CEO of a publicly traded company. All right. and your income is largely tied to your stock performance. You with me?
Yes.
And you reasonably expect, you and your entire best economic financial advisors and CFOs and everyone else, you thought before this whole pandemic, you thought that your stock price was going to give a dividend of, let's just say, $10 a share. All right? You with me?
I'm with you.
And because of this pandemic, you reasonably think that it's now going to be $5 a share. All right?
Okay.
What are you going to tell the analysts? What are you going to tell Wall Street? What are you going to tell all of your investors that you expect the earnings to be when you previously thought it was going to be $10? Now you really think it's going to be $5. What number are you going to tell your investors and your analysts to set their expectations?
I would presume $5.
Really? And you're not going to give yourself any margin for error? You're not going to give yourself any way to look like a hero? You're not going to use this as an opportunity to flush out every fucking mistake you've ever made?
Well, I think you're going to fix this for me, but right now, I guess I'm not thinking that way, no.
Well, what the CEOs are going to do is they're going to say, well, I was previously telling my investors and my shareholders and my board of directors $10, and they were bitching at me that it was 10 and not 11. Now I think it's 5, but I've got this perfect cover. I've got this perfect story. I've got this perfect excuse that no one can blame me for. And I can reset everyone's expectations. And I think it's going to be 5, but if I say 3 and it turns out to be 4, then I'm a hero. But if I say 5 and it turns out to be 4, then I'm a bum. So what are they all going to say? They're all going to say 3.
So the economy is actually better than what they're saying.
Stock prices are going to plummet. And stock prices are going to plummet. Everyone knows this. There's no one who doesn't know this in the world of finance. Everyone knows that this is how it is because everyone's been through this before and before and before and before. So we know the stock market is going to take a massive hit. The Fed is going to lower interest rates. The Fed is going to loosen up credit. Banks are going to be chasing you to give you money. Okay, well, what happens when that happens? People start businesses that they wouldn't have otherwise started. People make investments that they wouldn't have otherwise made. Are you getting to understand what I'm saying here?
I am. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Okay. In tough economic times, does that tend to strengthen family relationships or does that tend to strain family relationships? Which is it, Carrie?
Strain.
It strains family relationships. Therefore, divorce rates are likely to go up or likely to go down?
Likely to go up. Absolutely.
Okay, and what kind of behavior do people frequently, unfortunately, resort to in times of stress and pressure and anxiety? Positive, healthy behavior or not positive, unhealthy behavior?
Very not positive, unhealthy behavior.
So what kind of causes of action are you going to be bringing? And what kinds of allegations should you be anticipating 6 months, 9 months, 12 months from now in your family law cases?
Probably a lot of domestic violence, a lot of people not paying their support obligations, and yeah, probably a lot of divorce.
Divorce with a lot of substance abuse problems, right?
Yes, absolutely.
You already mentioned domestic violence. They're going to be fighting like cats and dogs over the few pennies they've got left. See, when everyone has lots of money, everyone's gracious. But when everyone's broke, they get vicious.
Right.
Am I telling you anything you don't already know? I mean, don't you now know exactly what's going to happen in the next year or so of family law?
I think I imagined that people would kind of resort to filing divorces and that all these things would happen. But, you know, I guess I have the fear that the money won't be available for clients to come hire, and then that'll make money less available to me to hire staff. And I think that's where my question came from.
In what world do people who are highly motivated not find money?
Right.
When people are motivated, they find money. You ever do criminal defense?
No, never have. No.
Well, go talk to some criminal defense lawyers about all of their clients who are broke and destitute, but yet somehow managed to scrape up cash to pay them thousands and thousands of dollars to stay out of jail when they're highly motivated. You know, you ever work with anyone that works with people with substance abuse problems?
Yes, in my office I have somebody who does, yeah.
Well, how exactly is it that this person was able to fund a $1,000 a month coke habit? Where did this money come from? When people are motivated, they always find the money. No one doesn't have money. What people lack are priorities.
Okay, so we have to help them prioritize this.
Well, it's not your job to help them prioritize. It's your job to help them get their own. Well, it's not up to you to tell them what their priorities are. It's to help you think through the implications and the long-term consequences of how they're choosing to prioritize things. This is going to be a subject of, I think, next week or the week after when we talk about sales. We're getting into sales.
Okay.
A parent whose spouse is violent or having drug problems and relapsing and engaging in very bad behavior and needs to file a divorce to protect themselves and to protect the family assets and to protect the children, that person's going to find the money, aren't they?
Yeah, they are.
They'll sell something. They'll borrow something. They'll beg something. They'll pawn something. They'll prioritize something. They'll get a second job if they need to. They will find the money if it's a big enough priority for them.
Understood.
Oh, and by the way, did you not notice that the government is giving away free money left and right?
That's, you know, I hadn't thought of that, but you're right. They are. So that's, I guess, some good news there for that. You're right.
So isn't the next 12 months of family law like really predictable now? I mean, there shouldn't be any real big surprises for you unless something drastic changes in the world.
Yeah, I mean, after asking this question and getting your answers, I think you're right. Yeah, it's definitely looking less scary, I think.
Okay, just to save us some time, anyone who does immigration, criminal defense, business law, intellectual property law, just take exactly what I just discussed with Carrie and just swap out family law and put in your own practice area. It's the same answer. Carrie.
Yes.
How many lawyers do you know who have already gone and fired their whole staff?
A few, and some that basically have away messages that they're not working for the next month.
Yeah, we call them out of business autoresponders.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
How many lawyers do you know? How many lawyers do you know who probably saw the opportunity to sign up for this workshop, boot camp, and didn't? You know anyone?
Actually, when I signed up, I asked in my Facebook group if anybody wanted to do it with me, and I know a few people that said no because of that same reason. So, a few people.
Okay. That's the face of your competition. So, when things return to normal, there will be a surge, right? It's not like people are going to stop filing divorce. They're just delaying when they file divorce. And when things return to normal in a month or 2 months, there will be a surge of new business. And where will those people be in terms of their law firms relative to where you're going to be? They're going to be out of business in 2 months. They will have laid off their staff. They will have basically gone to sleep. They will have stopped communicating with their clients. They will have not done outreach programs to their clients, their former clients, their referral sources. They will have basically disappeared, and you will emerge with a bigger, stronger, better law firm, and you will crush it, and they will get crushed by that surge. Don't you see that?
Now I do, yeah. I do.
Ditto every other practice area of everyone who's listening. So please don't raise your hand and say, do the same thing for me for my practice area, because it's the same conversation. Okay.
Thank
I don't
you.
Even remember what your question was, but thank you for asking it, because I guess it got me talking about this stuff.
No, you answered it
what
and
was
more.
Your question?
My question was whether I should hire somebody and whether these, you know, the coronavirus era was the right time to do it. But I think you answered that and more.
Not only is now a great time, not only is the answer yes, but what do you think is going to happen? It's, you know, for the last several years, we've had a really strong economy. And it has been a seller's market when it comes to staff. It has been really challenging to hire great people in the last few years because there's just been such a strong economy. Oh my God. I am like a kid in a candy store getting ready to scoop up superstars left and right who are getting let go by their employers. So, yeah, now's a good time.
That's a really good point. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, next question. Bolin, next question.
Paul, you're unmuted. Go ahead, sir.
Oh, okay, I see it. Great, Arjan, thank you for taking the question. I was wondering if you provide the possibility of interim coaching, because I kind of feel like I have, and I suspect I'm not the only one. There are a lot of business decisions and just marketing decisions, all kinds of decisions to be made over the coming weeks. And I feel a little bit like I'm, you know, driving around using Google Maps with bad internet and, you know, having to make decisions faster than the, you know, directions are being given. And so anyway, I'm just afraid that I'm going to be making decisions over the next month or whatever. And then I'll discover, you know, later that I shouldn't have done this or that.
So what is your question? I guess I'm a little bit confused.
Well, do you have interim, do you have like, is it possible to get on some coaching calls with one of your coaches or something like that? Or do we have to go through this 4-week program first, or how does that work?
I guess we can try to figure out how to do something for you as an interim, but I really think that you're going to find that if you take full advantage of this boot camp, you won't need that.
Okay.
Listen, okay. I'd be happy to take your money. I just don't think you need it, because okay, we're going to be on the phone every single week for a couple of hours. You're going to have the discussion form that me and my team are monitoring every single day.
Okay.
And we're probably, because of the pandemic, going to have at least one extra bonus session that's just sort of pandemic tactics related.
Okay.
If you feel like you really want or need more, then I can talk about accommodating you, but I'd like to encourage you to just try to get as much out of this as you can. I don't think you're going to need that. I mean, I'm not trying to talk myself out of business, but my goal is to earn a long-term, you know, most lawyers try to get a client so they can squeeze business out of the client. What we teach our members is get any little piece of work that you can so you can earn the right to call someone a client for life. And my goal, I mean, I think you guys are all smart people, and you understand that my business is not running virtual boot camps. I don't have a $15 million business with 50 full-time employees because I run a boot camp for 40 or 50 people once a quarter. This is obviously a way for us to develop a relationship, for me to earn your trust, and for us to look to have a long-term relationship. We've got members of How to Manage a Small Law Firm who've been with us since 2010. You know, once someone starts working with us, the only reason they should ever stop is when they bring in full-time in-house people. So the point that I'm making is, you know, just get as much as you can out of this boot camp. If you find that you have that you need something extra that you're not getting in the next few weeks, on the weekly calls and on the discussion forum and on the bonus calls, we'll help you out, and you won't have to pay for it.
Okay, sounds good. I'll reach out. Okay, sounds good. I'll make use of it. Thank you.
Yeah, and the deal is that in the future you will then say How to Manage a Small Law Firm is the greatest, and you'll refer lots of business to it.
Perfect. Okay, sounds good.
All right, up next we have Mike.
Hey, Arjun.
Mike, you're unmuted.
Thank you. Thanks for taking the call, Arjun. I had a question that was sort of related to the first one, so maybe I'll change it. But basically, when we're looking at this homework and what we're trying to do, and you made it a point to have us specifically with the financial portion to answer what you really want, not what you kind of, you know, think or what you're willing to accept. I mean, obviously, I'm assuming maybe incorrectly, but I'm in phase one, right, in terms of the growth stage. You know, I'd love to be able to say I want a $10 million home in 48 or 24 months or what have you. I mean, how aggressively
do you want $1 million firm in 48 months? Yes or no?
Yes, 100%.
Do you really?
Yes. Well, actually, more. Yes, bigger than. I mean, I want to have. Yes, yes. The answer is yes. No question.
Well, what is it? Is it a million dollar house because you want to say you own a $1 million house, or is there a house you know you want and it happens to cost $1 million? Which is it?
The latter. The latter. It's more than a million, but yes, the latter.
Well, how much is it?
2.2.
Okay, so you know the house.
I do.
And you know that it's $2.2 million.
Yes.
Okay. So it's a house. So it's that house or one just like it? Because, I mean, obviously, if that house gets sold to someone else, you can't buy that house. But that house or one just like it. So it's around a $2 million house, yes?
Correct.
Okay. So do you know what it costs to own a $2 million house?
As I was on the call, I was trying to do the math, and it's like $20,000.
So that means no.
No.
Okay, so you really have no idea. So a $2 million house isn't real for you. It's just a fantasy at this point.
Correct.
Okay, so what I want you to do is to make it real. Make it real in every way that you possibly can make it real. Figure out what it's going to cost for the mortgage. Figure out what it's going to cost for the taxes. Figure out what's going to cost for the insurance. Figure out what's going to cost for the maintenance. Figure out what's going to cost for the domestic staff to run a $2 million house.
Okay.
Approximately how many square feet is that house?
3,200, I think. I'm not exactly sure.
Wow.
That's roughly.
What market are you in?
Coconut Grove, Miami.
A $2.2 million house in Coconut Grove is only 3,800 square feet?
It's a condo, but yeah.
In what building? I happen to know the Grove.
It's Grove at Grand Bay. The two okay. Twisted spirally building, you know.
Oh, that's a brand new building, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So the point I'm making is figure out what it really costs to operate that house. Okay?
Yeah.
And then come to the call and say, this is what I want. Now, you may not get it, but if we're going to pursue a goal and fall short of it, let's at least pursue a goal that is motivating to you. Let's at least pursue a goal that you're going to be willing to take all your excuses and shove them up your ass to go after. Let's not set a goal that's milquetoast to you. That's like, Because here's the thing, setting honest goals causes us to behave in different ways than setting dishonest goals. If you say, well, you know, the house that I want or the condo that I want is $2 million and it's going to cost $25,000 a month to own that. Okay. $25,000 a month is $300,000 a year. $300,000 a year means we got to make $500,000 a year for the condo. Or I'm sorry, $400,000 a year for the condo. And that means that we need to do this and that and the other. Okay, you know, now we have an honest goal. We make a plan to achieve that goal, and that plan may scare the shit out of you. And that plan may require you to do things that are very uncomfortable for you. And that plan may require you to do things you've never dreamed of doing before. That plan may require you to do things that piss other people off, disappoint people, scare people, frustrate people, and make other people very, very uncomfortable. But if you build the plan and you're an intelligent person and you say, yes, there's nothing about this plan that I can find fault with, and you share that plan with me and my team and we all say, yep, that plan should work, and you share that plan with a bunch of other law firm owners who have built multi-million dollar law firms before, and they're all like, yep, that plan will work. Well, then it's just a question of how bad do you want it?
Right.
The problem is what people do instead is they say, well, you know, I don't really know how to do that. So instead of setting the goal for having a $2 million house, I'm just going to set a goal for a $500,000 house. And the $500,000 house doesn't motivate them. It doesn't inspire them. It doesn't put a fire in their belly. Well, if you're not motivated, if you're not inspired, if you don't have a fire in your belly, if you don't really, really have a burning desire for it, you're not going to be willing to go outside your comfort zone. You're not going to be willing to do what it takes to make it happen. You're not going to be willing to be awkward and uncomfortable and get up off the mat when you get knocked on your ass. You're not going to be willing to say fuck it to everyone who criticizes you for doing things you've never done before because you don't really give a shit about it anyway.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
Now listen, I promise every one of you, if you come back to me with a plan, it's like, oh, I want to have a $100 million house and a private jet and, you know, fly around in a private helicopter and have a, you know, blah, 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 blah. I mean, I'll help you make a plan for it. And I'll also tell you, I think you're completely full of shit, that you don't really want that. Because most people who set these outrageous goals, they don't really want it. It's a fantasy. It's just like mental masturbation. It's bullshit. It's not real. That's why I want you to be real for you. Have you been in that apartment yet?
Not in this one now.
But one just like it?
I've been in, well, not in this building. I've been to the building. I go by the building every day. It's like, it's part of my run. It's, I mean.
Go take a tour. Imagine yourself living there. Take a tour with the realtor and tell the realtor, I want to close my eyes and imagine myself living there. Please give me 20 minutes just with silence. And imagine yourself waking up there and imagine yourself using the toilet. Imagine yourself cleaning out the air filter and imagine yourself cooking a meal and imagine yourself coming home and imagine yourself just doing the routine day-to-day stuff of living there. Make that real.
Okay.
I got two stories to share with you and everyone who's listening to this. One is when I was a kid, when I was 16 years old, I'm a boater. I've always been a boater. I love boats. And when I was a kid, my dream boat was a 16-foot Donzi speedboat with a inboard outboard MerCruiser engine. And I had a poster of that boat on my wall when I was a kid, and I could tell you all the specifications, and I knew the horsepower, and I knew the weight, and I knew the speed, and I knew all the details of that boat. And when I got to a point where I actually had enough money to buy that boat, I took it for a test drive. And in 15 minutes, I was like, this is a piece of shit. I've been dreaming and fantasizing about this boat that sucks. Okay, next story. When we were broke, and I was really broke, when we were broke, my wife was driving an old Saturn, and I was driving an old truck, and she wanted to have a Toyota FJ Cruiser. That's the car she said she wanted to have, was a Toyota FJ Cruiser, yellow with a black interior. And we went onto the Toyota website and built that thing and built that thing and built that thing so many times over. And we dreamed about it and we talked about it. And it motivated us to do so many things that we were afraid to do to go get that car. And then the day came when we could afford to buy that car or lease that car. And we went down to the Toyota dealership and I was so excited. And we took it for a test drive and we got half a block. And she's like, I hate this car. And we turned around and we left.
Right.
And it's like, oh my God, we spent all this time fantasizing about something that we never even tried. Now compare that to the house that I live in. And I mentioned at the beginning of the call that I'm going to share a lot of personal stuff that's all true, and I'm not sharing it to impress anyone. I'm sharing it to impress things upon you. The house that I bought it 3 years ago. It was $2.5 million. I showed up at the closing table with $1 million cash, just under $1 million cash. Now remember, 10 years ago, I was completely and totally flat broke, and less than 10 years later, I have $1 million cash to show up at a closing table to buy a $2.5 million house. Now the thing is, I had the benefit of living in the house because I was able to lease it from the seller because I was previously renting the house next door to him. So we leased the house, we bought all the furniture that the house came with, we moved into the house, and we didn't have the money to close on the house because the bank kept jerking us around on the financing. And at one point, I had to come up with an extra $250,000 for the closing because the bank decided that they wanted more down payment. And I needed to come up with the money in 90 days. Let me tell you, nothing makes it real more than living in the middle of your burning desire. I had a burning desire to not have to move my family out of this house that we wanted to live in. And I found opportunities and I went through walls and I kicked down doors and I created so much value for so many people to have so much better businesses and so much better lives that within 90 days I raised the extra $300,000 because I raised the money for the taxes plus the down payment plus taxes. I raised almost $350,000 in 90 days, all because I was like driven because I really, really, really wanted it. Take all your excuses and shove them up your ass. Taye astuya. If you really want it, let's go make it happen for you. Now, as I said earlier, I don't give a shit what house anyone lives in. I don't care what car you drive in. I don't care whether you educate your kids well or not. They're not my kids and I don't know them. And I don't know most of you yet. But what I do know is that if you really want it, I've never, in 20 years of doing this, I've never met anyone who brought me a goal that they really, truly, honestly wanted that we couldn't make a reasonable plan to make the law firm do that for them. And then the next question people say is, so you're saying everyone you made a plan with all lives in the house they want to live in and drive the car they want to drive and educates their children the way they want to educate their children? And I say, tragically, no, because a lot of people are not willing to take all their excuses and shove them up their ass. We make the plan and then they don't do it. So send me an email offline, Mike, and I'll introduce you to my realtor here in Miami who will take you to that building. And he knows he will stand there and he will shut his mouth for half an hour while you just fantasize.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
All right. Up next, we have Alicia. You are now unmuted.
Okay. I started ahead. So I've been working on my niche magic statement, and my question does my firm need to have a niche, period? Because I do a little bit of this and a little bit of that, but 75%.
The narrower you, generally speaking, based on 20 years of experience doing this, I will tell you that generally speaking, the narrower you pick your niche, the faster it will be to grow the firm.
Okay.
The wider you go, the slower and the harder it is.
Okay.
Okay, I can explain why if you want. Otherwise, we'll leave it there.
No, I think I get it, because you just refer out to people if you're not doing it, and then just focus in on what you really like. For me, family law, which is
so, like, what different practice areas are you thinking about?
Well, what I, and that was part, you're going to say this sucks as far as my magic statement, which was I help people weather life's challenges from birth to death. And that's because my clients are the ones that, you know, that I have family law issues. And then the next thing I know, they want me to help them with an employment or a Social Security disability or personal injury. And so I end up doing those particular or a probate matter.
Let me stop you, Elisa. Mm-hmm. Elisa, mm-hmm. What were the firm's revenues last year? Just so we have a baseline.
203.
Roughly. All right, so we'll call it 200,000. Mm-hmm. And break that down into the different practice areas. Like, you know, 50,000 came from this, 25,000 came from that. Just roundabout. I don't need exacts.
Okay. About 100,000 came from family law. 50 came from, 60 came from probate. About 12,000 came from Social Security, and 30 came from, did I make 100? 30 came from,
yep,
from
okay.
Employment.
Okay, so let's just think about this practically speaking, okay?
Mm-hmm.
In order to get your Social Security disability practice working as well as your family law practice, you're basically going to have to document the same policies, the same procedures, the same systems, create the same checklist, create the same templates, create the same examples, and train your staff how to run all that, right?
Right.
So you're going to do all that to support a $12,000 practice. Whereas that exact same time and energy, if you put that time and energy into the family law firm, you could probably take that family law firm from $100,000 to $200,000.
Okay.
You follow what I'm saying?
Yes.
Okay. Also, you're never, ever, ever going to get a referral for a family law case, or probably not. Let's just say the odds are very much against you ever getting a family law referral from anyone who does Social Security disability, for the simple matter that they know you do Social Security disability, and they're going to be afraid that if they refer you a family law case, that you're going to end up turning that into a Social Security case for yourself.
Okay.
So you're going to either invest a ton of time and energy building up the infrastructure for a Social Security disability firm, which is a fraction of a percent of your practice, a small percent of your practice,
mm-hmm.
and which is actually repelling referrals away from you.
Okay.
On the other hand, if you took your Social Security disability work and you found the best Social Security disability firm that you could in your area that does not do family and does not do probate, and you said to them, I am going to focus on building my family and probate firm, and I'm going to get out of the Social Security disability world, and I would like to have a strategic relationship with someone that I can refer all of my Social Security disability work to, and they can refer me all of their family and probate work to, you'll find someone who will say, great, I don't want to do family or probate, and I'll take all your Social Security disability work.
Okay.
And then you can take all your Social Security disability cases and you can say, here's all my files. Give me 20% of anything you get. They're now your problem.
Okay.
I made up 20% as just to make it really easy.
Right.
Same thing with employment. So you can still get money from the cases that you've got, But if we're going to build a $500,000 law firm, let's build a $500,000 family law and or probate firm.
Okay.
The Social Security and the employment is like building a $500,000 family probate firm and dragging around a little anchor just to make it more complicated for ourselves.
Okay.
You got to build a marketing machine for a family law firm, and you have to build a marketing machine for probate. And now you have to build a marketing machine for disability, and you have to build a marketing machine for employment.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Then you have to build processes and policies and systems and checklists so that your team can actually handle cases without you having to micromanage them for family law and for probate and for Social Security and for employment. Are you seeing where I'm going with this?
Yes. Yes.
And the team that's going to get on board with the mission and the vision for the family law firm, that team is not really going to probably give a shit about employment law.
No.
And the team that's going to get excited about the mission and the mission and the vision and the way you want to make the world a better place through doing employment law, they're not going to care that much about probate. So you're attracting different kinds of people also. It's like when you interact with my team, you're going to find most people on my team are like really, really, really into our mission. And that's not by accident. It's because we recruit them for that. We recruit people who already have a similar perspective on the world that we do.
That's true.
So I would say let's build the family law firm or the probate law firm, your pick, I don't care. But let's focus on one of those for the next 4 weeks. I'm not saying to jettison the rest. I'm not saying to do anything rash right now. But mm-hmm. for the next 4 weeks, let's just focus on one of those. And I think that at the end of 4 weeks, you're going to see very clearly that one of them, either family law or probate, is probably going to be the way you want to go.
Family.
There you go. That was easy.
That's where my heart is. Yeah.
Then let's make that what we focus on for the next 4 weeks and build a business plan for a family law firm. And I think that once you build a business plan for a family law firm and you see just how quickly we can take it from a $100,000 firm to a $500,000 firm doing family law, I think you're going to be inspired and not scared of letting go of the rest.
Correct.
So don't let go of the rest now. Just let's just focus on building the family law firm and leave the rest alone for now.
Okay. So then I'll change my magic statement to fit family law. Okay.
Yeah. Great. Thank you for that question.
Thank you.
All right. And last but not least, we have Bob. Bob, sir, you are unmuted.
Okay, Arjun, thanks for all the great advice. I have a criminal defense practice, and on your financial controls piece, I was just wondering, something that we confront all the time, and I'm not sure how many other lawyers do, is that we are sometimes each year in stages 2 or 3 or 4. Very, very difficult for us to get our arms around projections and variances and things of that nature. Do you have any, is there a way that this process works for that kind of practice? Because it's basically wait to see what comes in. Although, I agree with you, we're very excited about getting our office, and you've given us great suggestions already. We're percolating and probably, unfortunately, looking at an inundation of cases coming forward. But still, we never know from week to week what's going to come through the door.
It's usually the contingency lawyers who are giving me that story. So this is interesting. So let me. Rather than give you an answer, let me guide you through a thought process that I think will get you to the answer you're looking for, okay?
Great.
First off, we agree that we live in a universe where causes lead to effects, yes?
Yes.
Okay. Let's just use networking as an example, okay?
Mm-hmm.
If we were to go to a well-chosen networking event, does it seem reasonable that if we really went out of our way to be an effective networker at a well-chosen networking event, we could find 3 people who would be high quality potential referral sources for us at that networking event?
Yes.
Okay. And like, for example, that networking event would not be a criminal defense bar meeting. It would be maybe a family law meeting.
We do that extensively with the family law attorneys, which in fact are our number one source of referrals.
Okay, great. So let's talk about that. So if we strategically pick networking events that were full of family law attorneys, family counselors, family therapists, drug and alcohol counselors and therapists and people like that. I mean, that's like a target-rich environment for referral sources, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. And if we went there and we were very strategic about how we worked the event, and we identified the three most influential people, and we left the event and at the event we found out what made a good referral source to them, and we found out and we turned the spotlight all on them, so they felt like the rock star, and then we made notes about that on the back of their business card and wrote them a thank you note the same day in blue ink and mailed it with a stamp and said in the thank you note, dear so-and-so, thank you. It was wonderful to meet you at the such and such event, and made a little reference to something they said to let them know we were really paying attention, and ended it with, if I ever run into a person who is, and then you describe their ideal referrals, their ideal type of client, because you asked them, I'll be sure to refer them to you. And you mailed them that letter, that handwritten note, the day of or the day after the event. And then you got back to your office and you took all the things that they said they were interested in, bowling, flying kites, and scuba diving. And their kid goes to Florida State studying biology. And you stuck all those things into what's called a rainmaking Rolodex, which is basically an old-fashioned round Rolodex where each card, instead of putting it under the person's name, you put their name under each of their interests. So you put this person's name under B for bowling, under K for model for flying kites, for S for scuba diving, and for B for biology, and you make a note of their kid's name. And then in the next few weeks or next month, you made it a point to send them some kind of an article or case or something of interest that's under some category that they're interested in. And over the next month or so, you made it a point to beat the bushes to refer them some kind of business. And then you followed up with them with an appointment to learn more about their business and educate them more about yours. Is it reasonable to expect that out of those three people, if you built a marketing system like that, is it reasonable to expect that you'd get at least one new case per year out of each networking event?
Yeah, and it's funny that we're networking with all the groups that you mentioned, but I can see from what you're saying, clearly our follow through sucks, actually.
Okay, so but you agree that if you were to have a follow-up system, which means that before you even go to the networking event, you know exactly what you're doing there. You're going there to find three people, not 30, just three. I don't care about the other 27. I just want you to find the three most influential, the right people. Okay?
Right.
If you find those three right people and you go there knowing that you're going to be sending them this thank you note, and you know that you're going to put them into your rainmaking Rolodex, and you know you're going to find something to send to them or get your secretary to send something to them on your behalf, and you know you're going to beat the bushes looking for a referral to give to them, you go into that networking event with a completely different intention than most people who are just wandering around. They don't know what to do.
Right.
So if you were to do that, I think that we both agreed that it would be pretty reasonable to expect that you get at least one new case out of each networking event, right?
Okay,
what's the average case worth? And while you're doing that, I'm looking online for something to post into the discussion for you. What's your average case or matter worth?
It depends on the matter and depends on the level of complexity in the case, but we're usually charging retainers of $50,000 to $100,000 on average per case.
Okay. So if every networking event were to reliably get you, because you implement an actual follow-up system, one new case per year, if you go to one networking event per month, then you can expect to get $50,000 to $100,000 of revenue per month. You go to two networking events per month, you can expect to get $100,000 to $200,000 per month. If you go to a networking event, skip 3 months, and then go to a networking event, skip 3 months, go to a networking event, skip 3 months, you can expect to get that every quarter. Mm-hmm. If you go to a networking event and then don't follow up, and then go to a networking event and follow up, and then go to a networking event and don't follow up, are you seeing where I'm going with this?
Yeah. Makes perfect sense.
Causes lead to effects. Hang on, I'm going to post this for you. Bob Berg is the author of a great book called Endless Referrals. And we actually have had Bob as a guest at one of our live quarterly meetings. And we actually just ran a 3-day workshop with Bob with about 25 of our members, teaching them about endless referrals and how to build a networking machine. And I just included the links to that. Oh, I think I just, wait. Sorry. Yeah, there it is. Okay, there it is. You can get the audio version of this as well as the printed book, and it will literally just lay out for you a networking blueprint. And Bolin, make sure that we include with them, make sure that I think the homework already includes in a later week a whole live quarterly meeting. It's like a 3-day workshop that we did on all about referrals, how to build a referral machine. So I'm just going to put here in the forum, someone ask, someone be sure homework includes LQM, live quarterly meeting on networking. The point I'm making, Bob, is causes lead to effects. Marketing is very reliable. It's very predictable. You can't tell on a micro level that this is going to produce a case tomorrow. But if you're running an annual, monthly, quarterly, systematic networking machine, and if you're systematically running webinars, for example, webinars to teach family law attorneys how to recognize and how to make a good referral. You know, each of these things you can build, it's going to have predictable results. So your revenue is an effect of referrals and clients calling you. The client calling you and the referrals are an effect of the marketing that you put out there into the world. If you put the networking out into the world in a deliberate, intentional, systematic way, it will make the revenues much more systematic and reliable also. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Absolutely. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And
Carlos, you've known Bob for 30 years. Bob's awesome.
Arjun, I was just going to tell you, that concludes the questions that we have for today.
Okay, great. So everyone get on the forum and log on to the forum and introduce yourself and share your financial goals on the forum. Don't be shy. And share your magic statement. Don't be shy. And I'll be on there and members of my team will be on there. Start doing the homework today. Start listening to it today. Just download it to your phone, download it to your computer, print it out, get it all ready so that tomorrow you can hit the ground running on your homework, because before you know it, it's going to be a week from now. We're going to be on the call, and I want to make sure you show up on the call loud and proud with lots of questions and let us help you. All happy campers? I'm going to assume that everyone's happy because no one's saying they're not. And I will
they're saying it in the chat.
I'll be on the forum soon.
Arjun, they're getting a lot of thumbs up and thank yous in the chat. So yes, everybody.
Yeah, I see that. Thank you. All right, everyone. I'll be on the call again next week, and I'll be on the forum between then and now. Bye, everyone.